This is XTP Media.
You're listening to Extended. Here are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 65 of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Today, I'm joined by Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society, and Tim, of course, is Editor-in-Chief of Aerospace Magazine. Tim, how are you?
Very well indeed, Peter. Good to be back.
Great to have you back. And Gareth Stringer, the Editor of Global Aviation Resource. Gareth, how are you today?
Hello, Peter. I'm really good. How are you?
Yeah, very, very good. Very excited about today's show. Change of title there. Gareth, what's going on at Global Aviation Resource?
Yeah, so having sort of handed over the editorship what, a couple of 3 years ago, I'm back to doing that now. Elliot, who was the last editor of GAR, and some of our other chaps have decided to go off and do something purely focused on historic aviation, which is their passion, and it's all very amicable. We wish them all the very, very best and look forward to seeing their new project. But GAR will carry on doing it's always done, and I drew the short straw and I'm back to being the editor.
Ah, so we get to see a bit more of you on the social media and stuff like that.
Yeah, I probably might need to brush my quill off and do a bit more writing as well, because I haven't done much of that recently. So looking forward to it.
Now, we're also very happy to welcome Roger Cruikshank to the show. Roger's an Air Force officer currently serving as a Eurofighter Typhoon pilot. He's also competed in the 2006 Winter Olympics in Italy in both the alpine skiing downhill and Super G events. Roger is the co-author of a new book, Speed of Sound, Sound of Mind. Roger, welcome to Extended.
Hello, and thank you very much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you with us. We're going to talk about that book shortly, but just for my benefit, I can get the downhill bit. What's the Super G event?
The Super G is effectively the downhill, but with a few more turns in it. So it's like it's kind of in between the giant slalom and the downhill. The downhill is pretty much just pinning it straight down the mountain,
yeah.
Where the Super G is effectively a few more turns on the way down there. So it's actually, Super G is almost a bit harder. You don't get the high speeds as you're doing downhill, but to be honest, you're still traveling as fast. But with Super G, the worst thing is trying to memorize the course. In downhill, you actually get a couple of warm-up runs before you do the actual race.
Right.
But in Super G, that's it. First run, you have to go for it.
Right. And what's more frightening, Super G or flying the Typhoon at low level?
Good question. But actually, I think to be honest, it is a question I get asked a lot. And you do definitely get more of a sense of speed in downhill racing, would you believe, than in a fast jet at low level. I mean, I guess it depends how low you go, but there are rules on that in the jet. So yeah, I think it depends on a few different variables, but they're both as fun, that's for sure.
Right. Okay.
That's a top gear episode in the making, isn't it? You know, Typhoon
yeah.
versus a luge.
Yeah, it's a great show. I'll volunteer for both.
Well, Roger, great to have you on board. We're going to talk about that book shortly, but do chip in, get involved, have some fun. It's great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
We've also got a great interview with Owen Zupp on his new book, Without Precedent, as well. So look forward to hearing that with Tim. We've got listener feedback with some recorded messages, as well as a promoting aerospace segment as well. So we've got plenty to get through. But first, just before we go to the news, I just wanted to mention something. Good supporter of the show, Mick Oakey, sadly lost his father recently. So we just wanted to send our condolences. Now, Mick's father, Wing Commander Trevor Winston Oakey, AFC BSC, was 91 when he passed away on October the 6th. His well-attended funeral in Devon was a celebration of his life and his passions as well. And they had a North American Harvard fly by as well. His very favourite aircraft, Mick says, of all the many types he flew from World War II onwards. So our deep condolences to Mick, his family and his friends on Wing Commander Oakey's passing. Okay, and on that point, let's move on and let's get started by what's caught our eye in the news. Well, today, as we record it, there is only one story on the national and the trade press, and that is, of course, the decision to award Heathrow the third runway option for growth in the southeast of England. At this stage, no second runway for Gatwick. Tim, let me come to you. It's breaking, lots of news flying around as we speak, but what's your first take on the news?
Okay, well, I mean, it's a positive step forward. Everyone, you know, if you've been following this, you know, the thing of airport expansion has been an ongoing issue that's kind of going on for decades, depending on how far you want to go back. In 2015, the Airports Commission reported. They said Heathrow was the best option. It then sat around for a while we had Brexit and the Prime Minister resigned. And then it's come back and we finally got a decision today out of the government, which said, yep, you know, we're going to take the Davis Commission recommendations and, yes, you know, we're going to approve a third runway. So, big positive step forward. However, there's then going to be now about 18 months of where the MPs are going to vote on it in 2017-2018. So there's nothing going to happen before then. Construction are not likely to happen before 2020 or 2021. So we're not looking at any, you know, operations beginning on a third runner before 2025. So, you know, it's obviously a good move, but what's going to happen now is I think politicians and Heathrow has got to work even harder and not waste a minute in getting the support together and laying out what are the mitigating factors, you know, in terms of environment, in terms of you know, emissions, things like that. What are they going to actually you know, incorporate into this proposal, and how's it going to work? Because there is a danger that after so much time has passed since the Davis Commission reported that it's going to open it up to opposition and you know, legal objections and people sort of saying, look, you know, it's been a year, and you know, if the MPs vote in 2017, 2018 for a kind of a final rubber stamp on it, then it opens it up sort of to the argument that, well, you know, traffic patterns have changed. We've had Brexit now. Is traffic going down? Do we actually need it? You know, shouldn't we look at you know, traffic growth patterns and the environmental factors again? And then if that happens, then you're back to square one again, and you know, it gets thrown out. So I don't think that will happen at this point, but people really need to get their ducks in a row and get working on it.
And Tim, does this totally rule out a new runway at Gatwick? Because as I understand it, the airport has an outstanding agreement with the local municipality not to expand, I think, up until 2018 or 2019. Is it within their gift to then set about adding a second runway to Gatwick? I mean, it surely needs it. We need more than one runway in the southeast, don't we?
it could be argued. Some people sort of said, you know, Heathrow is the business traffic. It's incoming traffic. It's what you want for, you know, business links for, you know, post Brexit economic boost. Gatwick is more on the tourist outgoing traffic. What I suspect Gatwick might do is have a backup plan ready and plan it ready. You know, keep it ticking over, keep it planning, and then if along in the next 18 months, you know, something does happen to Heathrow, or it does run into sort of a massive opposition, then they are ready to go and say, look, you know, guess what? We've still worked on our plan. It's still ready to go. Would you like this instead? You know.
Yeah,
I think that's what they'll be smart to do.
And does that also rule out anything at Stansted? Because there was talk of that as well recently. I know Gatwick's particularly let down by the fact the rail line can't be expanded. There's only one road, one major road that runs down there. Stansted surely is in a similar position, isn't it?
Well, I'm not sure about Stansted, but there was some talk, and I'm not up on this now, so I'd have to look into it, about boosting regional airports.
Yeah.
So there was some sort of stuff about, you know, maybe that's a boost for Birmingham. I've not actually sort of seen that post the announcement. So
yeah, because certainly some of the regional airports supported growth at Heathrow, didn't they?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that develops. But breaking news, it'll be interesting to see how that unfolds. Some major infrastructure changes in that part of the world. And sadly, a lot of people will lose their homes through compulsory purchase, I would imagine, in Harmansworth and places like that. So we'll watch that space with interest. Just staying in the civilian sector before we go on to some military news. Tim, Airbus just delivered the 10,000th aircraft. I also saw some press recently about Airbus taking over Boeing in terms of production by 2020.
That sounds feasible. Yeah, so I was there, the delivery of the 10,000th Airbus airliner. Amazing story.
I didn't know that.
it was a lovely brand new A350 for Singapore Airlines. Singapore Airlines, obviously, the launch customer for the A350, launch customer for the A380. And they're going to be, I think they've already put it on the service, restarting non-stop services to the US from Singapore to San Francisco. So lovely looking airplane, lovely on the inside as well. You went in there, I thought it was first class. It was actually business class. It looks that good. And a real milestone for European aviation in reaching that. There's a stat there in that they took them 19 years for Airbus to deliver their first 1,000 aircraft, and the last 1,000 aircraft will took them 19 months.
Wow.
And it'll take them another decade to do 20,000.
Right. Gosh. Things are moving at a pace. Let's move on to some military news. We've seen the Russian fleet moving through the Channel and around the British Isles recently, off on its way down to the Mediterranean, we believe. Anything interesting there, Gareth, apart from lots of smoke? I thought smoke screens went out with the Second World War.
I know, it was about as smoky as a MiG-29, wasn't it? They obviously like that. For me, it was just the fact that it happened, because, you know, I'm in my 40s, and when I first got into, you know, aviation, the Cold War was still in full swing, and, you know, Phantoms were launching from Lucas, you know, marauding bears, you know, and sometimes they get down as far as the Wash and all that kind of stuff. It was just the fact that it happened for me, because it was just... It does genuinely feel a little bit like we've gone back to the Cold War. And there were some reports on the TV saying that there's a lot of people in Russia, whether it's due to sort of news propaganda or what, but they genuinely feel that that's where we are now. And I thought the whole thing was fantastic. It was sort of proper sort of bravado and, you know, why are you doing it? Because we can, kind of thing. I'm sure we used it as a good opportunity to get some a bit of information.
Yeah, and the Russians definitely, well, they know how to puff their chest out. And it's worth mentioning for, you know, for me and my speaking jit, because actually my first ever Q shift was when the Kalashnikov was sitting off the coast of the UK. And I was sitting in my rubber suit waiting, ready for the call. And it literally was my first ever Q shift. And I was pretty terrified, to be honest, of the fact that this thing was sitting, you know, out to the east of us. I mean, you could almost see it with a pair of binoculars. And yeah, we were quite excited about going and, you know, to go and inspect what it was doing. But it was all to do with whether the fighters would actually, the flankers would launch off the aircraft and whether they would kind of stray outside a certain boundary. But in the end, they didn't, unfortunately, so we didn't get up to go and say hello. But yeah, I remember that vividly, and that was about, that must have been about 3 years ago now, I guess.
Roger, then how far or how close were you allowed to get to, because the photographs we've seen, I know cameras are pretty good, but some of the photographs we've seen, particularly from civilian aircraft, is pretty close.
Yeah. I mean, for us, when it comes down to going alongside, say, when I've intercepted, you know, things like the TU-95 Bear, and I come across that, then, yeah, we can close up to a distance which you can effectively see someone waving at you, you know, from the inside with a camera, a true story. So, you know, so when it comes to other aircraft, it depends what they're doing and what orders we get given, obviously, from the chain of command. But yeah, we can, especially when it comes to the aircraft, we can go up, you know, right alongside them. And that's what I've had to do in a few different situations, just to make sure that we can identify them and, you know, identify any stores that they're carrying, so that we can pass that back to the chain of command.
You know, while we're on the subject, obviously we're talking about the Russian Navy here, but I wonder, Roger, what's your impression of the Russian Air Force capability today, you know, without going into, you know, classified stuff, but, you know, equipment, training, tactics, should we be worried, or are they just a paper bear?
I mean, to be honest, obviously, all these views are my own. This is probably the first thing to get out there, you know, as soon as I can. But when it comes to it, I think we are, you know, we are very much more capable when it comes to how big is our stick compared to theirs, you know, be it the aircraft, the missiles, you know, the systems that we have. However, you know, they have been doing this for a long time, obviously, as we have. So they do have some, you know, some tactics that they've evolved. But for us, I don't think we should be worried. I think we just have to keep on doing what we're doing. I mean, the only worrying thing is the defense budget cuts and the fact that we're trying to stay ahead of the game the whole time. But we've got, you know, we need money to be able to do this. And that makes it very difficult when we are, yeah, trying to stay ahead of them, really, is the main aim. But I think when it comes to our training, you know, and how we train our pilots, and how we actually use our systems, I think we're far more supreme. I'm sure you'd never hear that from them. I'm sure you'd never hear that from their press, but I do, you know, fully believe that.
And one interesting thing, I don't know who I'm putting this out to, I read recently, was about India's MiG-29s, their Ks. They're having terrible, terrible problems with those. Is reliability, I suppose, one of those challenges that we sort of see from afar that always seems to have plagued the Russians?
Yeah, I think when it comes to reliability, I mean, if you look, for example, at their Bear fleet, and they were grounded for a long time. So, you know, we always to they used to come around the northern plain there and come down to say hello to us, to the UK coast, or hopefully not as close as the coast. And with that, we'd always be looking out for them. But they did get grounded with quite a few engine fires, I think, that resulted from some fuel line malfunctions, but or whatever it was from the huge life of the Bear. You know, it's been going on for a long time. It's an impressive bit of kit, especially when you get close to it, and you can almost hear and feel the power coming off the propellers. even when you're in the Typhoon with all that noise around, it's an incredible bit of kit. But yes, definitely, due to whatever reasons they have, not just the Bears, but the rest of the Russian Air Force, it really does, suffer in some instances from reliability. I think that's where we're in a good place today. You know, when we have the Eurofighter Typhoon, it is an incredible bit of kit. You know, like we were joking about as we were speaking before this interview, that actually... you can just turn it off and turn it back on like any computer, and it will work absolutely fine. It's just a case of resetting it and getting all the zeros and ones to line up properly.
I'm sure it's slightly more complicated than that.
I'm just a pilot. So.
Yeah, we'll take your word for it. Sticking with the Navy, the Royal Navy, Tim, Unmanned Warrior 2016 multinational event. 40 research and development companies showing off their latest kit. What have we seen? Is there anything interesting coming out of this? Because the last I heard, the Navy was under defence cuts for unmanned aerial vehicles, and it was more a threat than an opportunity.
So Unmanned Warrior, it's been a big robot wars, I suppose. Obviously the usual headlines that have come out of it. It's looking at autonomous systems, UAVs, things that fly, USVs, things that float, and UVs that go under the water. So companies, organizations involved in this, so basically looking at kind of maritime surveillance, anti-submarine warfare, stuff like that. Some really interesting stuff from the UAV side of the house. Scan Eagle, Boeing brought a Scan Eagle with a nice 180-degree sensor. It's an optical radar. Basically, it automatically picks up surface objects, so jet skis, boats, even air objects as well, like helicopters or other drones, even a sub-periscope. So the idea with that is it solves one of the big criticisms of small UAVs or any big UAVs, in fact, is that you've got the soda straw effect of a small sensor ball, and you could miss stuff, and there could be stuff out there that you miss. So, and it automatically picks up as well. So that was interesting. Watchkeeper turned up, Army Watchkeeper. So what was that doing at sea? Well, it was flying over the littorials. It was the Thales was showing off a new maritime radar mode on its radar. It's got radar and an optical sensor. And as well, there was Leonardo / Selex. And they've got a new little Picosar EASA radar, very small, looks like a little briefcase, flat pack EASA radar, and also an ESM system for sort of sniffing out threat radars, hostile emitters, that kind of thing. And those were being demonstrated. So all sorts of interesting stuff there. And it's not based around any contract. So it's kind of like a sort of – it put me in mind of the kind of trials and manoeuvres that the early aeroplanes did in 1913, 1912, where, you know, the Army at that point just created the Royal Flying Corps. No one really knew what aeroplanes could do. There were also airships around at the same time. And people were just kind of getting grips with the technology of well, you know, how are they best used? What are we going to do with them? And it was using them there and playing with them and toying with them and working out that people, oh, actually, these are great scouts. Lo and behold, 2 years later, First World War breaks out, and you find out, well, actually, yes, you know, these can go over there. You can direct artillery, drop bombs, fight over aircraft, etc., etc. So, very, very interesting demo. A lot of food for thought.
Tim, did you just say a flat pack radar in a briefcase?
about the size of a briefcase.
We finally caught up with 007, yeah. Basically, haven't we? that's absolutely bonkers.
Can I have one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is amazing stuff now, isn't it? It really is. All the unmanned vehicles, the helicopters, or all those. It's a new world we're moving in. But sadly, just before we leave the news, Gareth, again, as we come to record, sad news about Bob Hoover.
Yeah, Bob Hoover has passed away at the age of 94, and we felt we should mention him because without putting any airs and graces on this, Bob Hoover is one of history's greatest pilots. There is, I don't think that anybody can possibly argue with that fact. Bob was a fighter pilot in World War II. He was shot down. He was a prisoner of war. He escaped by stealing a Fokker Wolf, true story. He became an Air Force test pilot. He was Chuck Yeager's chase plane pilot when he broke the sound barrier. And in later years, perhaps became best known for this incredible aerobatic routine in a twin aircraft with both of the engines feathered. But that in a very brief sentence is the career of Bob Hoover. Absolutely unforgettable, a huge inspiration, I think, to so many people. And very, very sad that he's passed away. And if I might just quote, there was a tweet put out by the Smithsonian, and his aircraft is actually in the Smithsonian, and it sums it up far better than I ever could. It said, we mourn the passing of our friend Robert A. Bob Hoover, the greatest stick and rudder man who ever lived. Rest in peace, Bob. You're an absolute legend.
Hear, hear. Thanks for that, Gareth.
Yeah.
Okay, there's still plenty to come, and after the break, we're going to talk to Roger about his new book, Speed of Sound, Sound of Mind.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society has a range of specialist groups, which focus on a specific domain or discipline. They form a vital interface between the society and the world at large, and serve both the interests of enthusiasts and professionals through debate, conferences, lectures, and other activities. Learn how you can get involved. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
G'day, I'm Dave Homewood of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's only regular aviation podcast series. The Wings Over New Zealand show covers all sorts of aviation topics, with a New Zealand flavour but an international appeal. From interviews with veterans and aviation personalities, to topics like military aviation, warbirds, air shows, historians, authors, museums, aviation events, and much, much more. We have an extensive archive of episodes that you can go back to, and there are new episodes coming out all the time. Search for the Wings Over New Zealand show. Oh, and by the way, we love Extended. It's a great show. Well done, guys.
Okay, so we've got Roger with us, and we've already heard a little snippet about some of the things he's done in his career. But Roger, let's go back. You're flying another Typhoon now, but where did this all start?
Yeah, I mean, it started, I guess, when I was a wee lad, and anything with an engine I was fascinated by, and especially anything that went fast. And I think also because my godfather was in the Navy, so he was, or he ended up being quite a high-ranking officer in the Navy. He was the station commander of Portsmouth for a wee while. But he was the one that I ended up kind of going to see and visit, and on HMS Invincible, that he was one of the senior officers on that. And he actually got me gave me the chance to look around one of the Harriers on that. And that coupled with, and I remember it absolutely just so clear as this day, is I was standing, I was on a mountain bike actually, and I was in this valley, one of the Scottish glens, and we're over in the Ladder Grew, so kind of over on the west coast there. And I remember hearing this noise and looking back over my left shoulder, and I was standing quite high up in this on the side of this glen, and seeing this Harrier side slip and then coming absolutely pinging down the glen beside us. And from that moment on, I remember saying to my friend who was there with me, and he reminded me of this about 15 years later, and I said to him, "That is what I want to do. I'm going to do that." And that was me set. That was an ambition right there that I had firmly planted.
So first question is then, why the Air Force and not the Navy?
Yeah, well, good question. And and although he's retired from the Navy now, though, but my godfather actually said to me, don't join the Navy, go and have your shot at the Air Force first. Now, but his reasoning behind this was that, you know, I'd get much more chance of, you know, doing what I wanted to do in the Air Force when it came to actually flying. So that's why he said, yeah, go for the Air Force.
Okay, so take us through your selection and your early years of flight. Did you learn to fly with the Air Force?
Yeah, so I was lucky enough to get a flying scholarship. So when I was what would have been 16, I went down to OASC at IF Cranwell and went through the process there and put myself down for a cadetship as well as an RAF flying scholarship. With a cadetship, as you maybe know, obviously to go to university and be sponsored as a bursar through university. So I was trying to get into that. But unfortunately, I never got that, but I got the flying scholarship. So to be honest, that was the one that I wanted because it was 20 hours free flying tuition. And it was in a Cessna at Tayside Aviation, so Glenrothes Airport. So at that point, after doing the test and et cetera, and to be honest, not having a huge amount of, you know, self-confidence and not, you know, I always knew I wanted to be a pilot, but I just didn't really think I'd be that good enough. And with my godfather pushing me and saying, yeah, no, you should definitely go for it. You know, you've got the skills from all the skiing and stuff you've been doing and, you know, you're really keen. So you've got the attitude, so give it a shot. So I went for it, and that coupled with doing the 20 hours free flying tuition at Tayside Aviation, I absolutely fell in love with flying. And that's when, yeah, it kind of all blossomed from there.
Right. Okay. So what was the journey through, to where you are today? I was going to ask the inevitable question of how did you get 20 hours flying at Tayside Airport without it raining snow? Was weather a real challenge?
That is for sure. And yeah. And again, I have a very vivid memory of trying to line up on the centre line at the Fife Airport there. And as I was coming across, I remember my instructor saying, oh, no, don't worry. All you have to do is just drop the wing a little bit. So I was pretty much already parallel with the runway, as in I was, sorry, offset but parallel, but offset by about, I don't know, 50 metres, something like that. Yeah. And all I had to do was drop the wing because the crosswind was so so strong that pushed me into the centre line. And it was a case of just crabbing all the way down. So, yeah, I guess from an early age, you know, early experiences in there with flying, I learned a lot about the weather and how to, well, avoid it or to just roll with it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was always very interesting for me.
And where did you do your primary training and what did you fly with the RAF?
Yeah, so it was the Grob Tutor from elementary flying training, and that was at RAF Witten in Cambridgeshire. So that was, that was good. That was a fantastic experience, and it was really good to fly the Tutor, actually. It was a really excellent aircraft, really good fun, especially when it came to aerobatics, actually. That thing is a bit of a ninja. And then from there on to the Tucano, because luckily out of the end of VFT, I got streamed fast jet. So I went on to the Tucano at Linton on Ouse in Yorkshire. Did the 9 months there to get my wings. So fortunately got the wings at the end of that. It wasn't an easy course for me. I found it quite hard. I struggled a few courses or a few of the tests within that course. To be honest, I think that's what made me a better pilot. It showed how hard things can be, but you have to just remain positive and get through it.
But Roger, what were the sorts of things that challenged you? Because we've got a lot of people who are really interested in careers as pilots and see the military route as the main one into that. What were the sorts of challenges you had? Because I think, you know, when I did my PPL flying, I had that same feeling, God, I'm just not good enough. And I had a lot of people supporting me through that. As it proved, I was right and they were wrong. But What were the sorts of things that that challenged you? Because I think certainly in the position you're in now, flying the Eurofighter Typhoon, you know, it gives heart to some people to know some of those challenges that you faced.
Yeah, and absolutely. And sorry for such an early plug of the book, but this is the kind of things that, you know, I talk about in the book. I actually learned from a very early age, or from a very early experience in my flying career. So, you know, for example, going through my flying training, to be honest, initially, and I remember it well on the Tucano, where I was doing really well, and I was getting fours and fives, as in the grading system was from zero if you completely failed the trip to six, and that would be the absolutely exceptional best. So I was getting fours and fives, and I was doing quite well, and I really wasn't struggling, and I was my confidence was high, and I was going through absolutely fine. But then I had a couple of slip-ups, and then I made, you know, a few mistakes, I think, which kind of cost me dearly. And that was just on one single trip. And that one single trip really took me down, and it put me into this spiral, this negative spiral, which made me really worry about what I was doing. So then what happened was I started second-guessing everything I was doing, rather than just, you know, leaving it to being a bad day. And that's what it came down to. The trip that I'd really struggled on was just a bad day. It was just a bad sortie. And everyone can have those. I know that now, but I didn't know that back then. Yeah. And it was very hard to get over. So, you know, luckily, I actually had a chop ride with a chief instructor at Lintanus. And it was Cunningham, that's right. And he effectively sat me down and said, "Rog, look, like, this is crazy. You've been doing so well. So what we're going to do is we're going to go flying, and I'm not going to fail you. How about that? Let's just go flying." And he just kept it as cool. And this was, so I'd failed two trips before that point. So this was effectively my chop ride. But because he said that, you know, he was probably playing games with me, but at the same time, he knew that from my grades before that I was doing absolutely fine. So there's no reason that I should be this bad, you know, as what had been happening in the previous trips, or, you know, the very recent trips. So we went flying, and because he just put me at ease, and because I relaxed, and because I thought, well, to hell with it, I'll just give it, you know, my best shot, and I'll just be as good as I can be. Because I secretly knew that he was maybe playing games, but I thought, well, he said he won't fail me, so I'll take his word on it. Yeah. I'll take it to court. So I went through it, and I did really well. And actually, I flew really well, and he was obviously impressed. He let me continue. And then the rest of the course went well. I had a couple of hiccups again, and that was, again, me just allowing my self-confidence to drop. So I think, you know, what it comes down to is it all being in the mind, and you not just accepting that, you know, sometimes things can go wrong, especially within flying, because there's always so many things that you've almost got to be thinking, next event, okay, what do I need to think about next? And with that, but if you have a next event and that goes terribly wrong, you can't keep dwelling on that. You've got to look forward, or just, you know, remain in the moment and think, right, I just need to be as best I can now, and then we can land. And I've learned this in my flying career as well, is to put your hand up and just say, okay, I absolutely minced that. I made a complete mess of that. Let's talk about it. Right, there we go. This is why I think I did it. And then move on. And I find that when you say that in front of, you know, a group of red-blooded fighter pilots, and they look at you and they go, yeah, fair enough. And that's it. That is the end of the conversation. It'll never be spoken about again. And people don't care because you've already discussed it. Yeah. So even if you make a major mistake, then you can talk about it, learn from it, so other people learn from it as well. And then you just move on.
And Roger, is I sort of get from what you're saying that there's a lot of pressure that one puts on oneself, and I'm sure we would all recognise that, because we're talking about, you know, ultimately the elite of the elite UK flying population in the job that you do today. Is it self-imposed pressure? Is it just the egos that drive those people through? Or are you trying to live up to expectations?
I think it's a mixture of everything, but I think the underlying main problem is that we all have a fear of failure. Mm. So when we're surrounded by people who are for doing really well, I guess, and you know, they're just Yeah, like for example, when you're going through the training system, they're just passing everything, and they tell you, "Oh, yeah, I did really well at this. I got the scores," and you maybe, per chance, you know, find out what scores they've got, or they tell you. So you have an idea of how you're faring against other people. So that's through the training system, and I think with that, it's a case of it is self-imposed because you're just trying to. It's not a competition because at the end of the day, you're just doing it for yourself to try and pass the grade. But actually, the instructors almost can't help but compare you against the other people in your course. So it does almost become a bit of a competition.
Yeah.
But then you find the courses because I was a course commander when I was an A2 qualified flying instructor, QFI, at RAF Valley. And you found that the courses that worked the best were the guys who talked to each other, or the guys and girls that talked to each other. And they helped each other with, "Oh, mate, I messed up with this today. Or, you know, don't you do this?" Or just telling the stories. Or people who go back to the bar for, you know, for one beer, I'd say just one, especially nowadays, and would, you know, come up with these stories so that everyone learns from them. And then if you get that kind of bred into the course, then actually the guys do really well because just learning from each other the whole time. And then, say, fast forward to frontline careers and how we operate, it's definitely self-imposed because we just want to be the best. And I know that sounds a bit cheesy, but it's just because we do have a lot of pressure. And, you know, especially when it comes to the job of intercepting a Russian bear or, you know, the operations that are ongoing at the moment, dropping bombs and the like. So there is definitely a sense of, well, you know, I have to do this job and I have to do it as well as I can. Especially in the typhoon, it's quite hard because there's just so much information thrown at you. Yeah. You know, you have everything to your disposal, which is great, but it can be actually the worst thing at the same time because it's all about learning. And I know this now, and you know, I've got about 650 hours in the typhoon at the moment, and I'm only just starting to know when to look, when and where to look at the right time. So that's what makes you a good pilot, I think, is when to absorb the information and where from at the right time. But you can actually apply that to anything in life. You know, when you're driving a car, when you're riding a bike, you know, when do you look ahead at a junction to see what's going to come pinging out to maybe kill you, you know, a car or something, and when to apply the brakes, you know, things like that. It's just knowing when to do it.
Wow. Okay. So how did you get into that, the front seat of that typhoon then?
Yeah. So I, as I mentioned before, I went from the Tucano at Linton Ouse, and then I went to RAF Valley, and I went through the course initially. And honest to God, especially after I was struggling through the Tucano, all I ever wanted to do was fly a Hawk solo. So I got there and ticked that off. It was incredible. But of course, at that point, it was like, right, okay, now I really want to complete the course and I really want to get into Typhoon. Because I think as a young guy playing computer games when I was younger and like all flying games and just... You know, that was one of the ways I really got into flying, actually, was computer games.
Yay!
Things that was... Hey.
Tim's with us now. You've woken him up.
And that was always spoken about. Spoken about and discussed and kind of dreamt about in the world of computer games and the like was the Eurofighter Typhoon. And because it was the new thing on the shelf that was coming into action, I got really excited about it. And that was my dream in life, my ambition was to fly a Typhoon. So I got to, through the course at Valley, learning to fly the Hawk and did, well, fortunately or unfortunately, really well in that, they decided to make me an instructor at Valley. So I stayed there. In the end, I actually stayed at RAF Valley on Anglesey for 5 years. However, it was fantastic and as I'll maybe mention later on, I've got loads of stories and I learned so much about flying in that Hawk T1 with no computers, just throw the switches forward and get airborne and you'll be fine.
Is that the now, aircraft you nearly died in then?
Yes. Yeah. About three times. later on. But yeah, that it definitely gave me some interesting stories to remember and to use that airmanship that I learnt from experiences I had in the Hawk onto the Typhoon. So then, yeah, did luckily well in the weapons training part of the Hawk T1 course, the advanced flying training, and then they selected me to go into Eurofighter Typhoon. So then I started the Typhoon, would have been about April 2013, and I've been flying ever since.
Right, okay. Wow. So tell us, what's she like to fly? I know we've talked to Jamie about this as well. What's she like to fly?
Ah, she's incredible. Absolutely incredible. And I'm sure Jamie would have said that as well. It's I remember when, I think, yeah, it was my first solo, and they put me into a single-seater, so a fighter, because obviously when you're going through the OC, the Operational Conversion Unit, they often put you in a twin-seater, you know, for most of your trips, and that's the aircraft that they major on in that squadron. But for this, I was in a fighter, and it had no tanks, had nothing. It was completely clean. And the thing was just an absolute beast, you know, accelerating down the runway, getting kicked onto the back of the seat. And then getting airborne on that was like the Hawk T1 on steroids, you know, especially when it came to the thrust. However, a lot of people, you know, ask me, you know, how it is to fly, how it compares, for example, to the Hawk. And it is very different. The Hawk being like a little go-kart, really, you know, something that's very raw. You know, you can really chuck it around, and it gives you so much response back. So, for example, I love my sports cars, and it compares to like a kit car, a Westfield I had, and the way it was just all very raw. You know, as soon as you put your foot on the brake in the Westfield, you get that kind of feeling of how much you had to push. You know, and when you went to the corners, it would really rattle you, but you knew how much it was gripping. So with the Hawk T1, it was very much like that. You could dive into a corner and apply backstick pressure, and it would give you that, you know, that very clear light, medium, or heavy buffet. So you knew how much energy you were bleeding off the wing, or you know, which was absolutely critical when you're going to the weapons training, when you're doing the basic fire maneuvers, the BFM, the dogfighting. So you take that into the Typhoon. It's a completely different beast. Now, like I was saying before, it's got so much information to throw at you that is half the battle, is knowing where to look and when. But when it comes to the actual maneuverability of it, it is absolutely incredible. You know, the fact that you can just roll and pull, and all of a sudden you're 9G, you're almost greying out. And the thing is just an absolute beast. And it's almost, you've got to actually, for example, when you're maneuvering it like that, you've got to position your body to be able to cope with the G. So not just the fact of doing the anti-G strain maneuver, it is actually, if going into a dogfight, I need to push my shoulders to the side. So if I'm taking him down the left-hand side, doing a left-to-left pass, then at that point, I am going to make sure that I've angled my shoulders and my head before I actually apply G. Otherwise, I'm going to really bust my neck. And, you know, there's a lot of people in the Typhoon Force who have bust their necks and are no longer able to fly the thing because it's that brutal on the body. Oh, yeah. So the maneuverability is, you know, is incredible. And also the fact of the carefree handling, the fact that you can just do that is literally roll the aircraft and pull, you know, and just pull the column towards you and not have to worry anything about the G-force going over the 9G limit, because it just won't, she won't let you. So in that respect, it is an incredible bit of kit. Yeah.
Rog, you've just touched on this, but if we could just maybe a little bit more depth. I interviewed Matt Dorbin a few years ago about flying the Jaguar, and Matt had gone on to fly the Typhoon, and he was telling me that when he flew the Jaguar, most of his capacity was taken up with actually flying the aircraft itself. When you go to Typhoon, you know, actually flying the aircraft is, in inverted commas, easy. Mm-hmm. But you know, he gave me a brilliant quote. He said, in the Jaguar, you were always fighting the crocodile that was closest to the canoe.
Yeah.
Whereas in the Typhoon, your situational awareness needs to extend, I don't know, let's call it 100 miles, you know, just for the sake of argument.
Yeah.
If we assume that most of the guys who get to the OCU can actually learn to fly the aircraft quite quickly, how hard is it to get that picture in your head and actually learn to operate the aircraft?
Yeah, it is hard. And it depends on what aircraft you've come from. So the Hawk T1, like I said before, with no computers and no, you know, MHDDs, none of the head down displays, the TV screens effectively in front of you to give you that information. Compared to, say, the Hawk T2, which has got all of that, you know, it's very much glass cockpit, it's all there, and it's actually very similar to the Typhoon. So it depends which era you've come from and which aircraft, the Hawk T1 or the T2 that you've come from, for that, because you're quite right in that it is the battle space awareness is what it's all about in the Typhoon, especially with this multi-role capability. I mean, especially like you say, when it comes out to whatever distance it is, you've got to have that that general awareness of what's going on around you and the ability to draw that out of the information that is given to you. So, you know, quite often we'll sit down and we'll debrief and we'll have all the screens up there in front and we'll be able to contrast and compare and look at situations and go, all right, Blogsy, can you see what you've missed there? So, of course, when you're sitting, as we are now, in our 1G chairs, it's very easy to go, oh, damn it, I missed the fact that he was, you know, doing death one, which means it was because of electronic attack, you know, jamming. So, therefore, I couldn't figure out, you know, that actually he doesn't exist. That was just a figment of the radar's imagination. You know, things like that where you can look at with your greater awareness and start to figure out. And it is definitely with more experience, you start to draw these things out and know where to look. But that is the hardest thing, is trying to get that battle space awareness.
Is it largely a function of experience, Roger? Can we train guys and girls to improve their situational awareness and their capacity? I'm assuming they are two different things, but you know, I'm assuming, yeah, if your capacity is greater, your situational awareness presumably will be better as well. Can we train people, or is that just something kind of you've either got it or you haven't?
Yeah, no, and that's, again, it's a good question, and asking, say, you know, a QFI, which I was before Typhoon, and I was a combat ready workup instructor as well for the guys on my previous squadron. So, you know, from that, it is very hard to judge people's capacity. You know, it is, you can do it as much as you want, but, or you can try and figure it out. But actually, unless, you know, on the early days of flying training, when people can not even say their own name, it's very easy to judge. You know, like when they're coming into land and you just ask them their name and they can't reply, then they're at full tilt. You know, and that might not always change, because those guys or girls can be, you know, like that to begin with, but then they just develop this capacity, just grows and grows. And that's another thing about flying training. You can't look at someone right in the early days and go, oh, mate, you don't have any capacity, I'm sorry, you know, you weren't able to state your name on landing. So, but, you know, compared to someone else, but actually that can grow and it can change as they just get more comfortable with the environment, with the aircraft, et cetera, et cetera. But yes, I think when we look at trying to train, you know, people into the new Air Force as it is, because it is changing with all these systems and all this information that we're given, especially with the HMSS, the helmet mounted symbology system, is, you know, that's another kettle of fish as well. That's another bit of information that you've got to process and know how to use it properly. But I think with the training system and with the Hawk T2, it's quite good in that the guys can actually go down into a room which is not with the big simulators. It's just with the small, just really computers, but they've got all the switches in front of them, and they can go through everything and use it as they would for real within the within any flight, in any scenario, and just practice and practice what I call playing the piano, you know, like the HOTAS, the hands on throttle stick. Yeah. You know, just knowing what switches to press at the right time, the amount of times, because, you know, bear in mind that I went from the Hawk T1 to the Typhoon, and that was a big jump. You know, and I was an experienced Hawk T1 pilot because of QFIing, you know, and I got plenty of hours on the Hawk. But wow, to go to something that was just throwing all this information at you, and then playing the piano where we had a few switches, and now we had, you know, 100, or we had, I'm not sure what it is off the top of my head, but it's like 52 switch selections just using your hands, you know, as not even leaving them off the throttle and stick. So for that, just learning that, you know, and playing the piano, so you're making it a lot more instinctive, that is almost half the battle. So I think with capacity, it's to do with how you learn these skills, but not to do with how quickly you learn them, because it can take you a while. You know, like, I don't think I'm especially a quick learner. You know, like, I would have guys who would be getting much better scores than me through the training system initially, but then I would catch up with them. And I guess that's just because I wasn't that quick, but then I would get there. And then because I got there with the skill sets, then my capacity would grow as well. In other words, I'd be instinctively able to play the piano and do all the flying stuff, and then my capacity would grow, and I'd be able to process the battle space a lot better. And trust me, I'm not anywhere where I want to be, because I think we're perfectionists and we're always trying to be the best we can and to get better and better at the skill, because you always miss something. I know every single flight, if someone was to tell me that, no, I had a perfect flight, they were absolutely lying. There's no way. We're always making mistakes, but as long as we, you know, admit to them and be honest about them, then everyone learns, we learn, and we get better at what we're doing.
So, Roger, you went on then to write this fascinating book that shows your journey. And you mentioned it earlier. You mentioned wanting to be an Olympic skier. What was that all about, and how did things go a little tragically wrong for you?
I grew up and I was very close to the ski hill, the Lecht. It was only about 50 minutes from me in Scotland. So I grew up in kind of Aberdeenshire, Royal Deeside. I used to go across and I absolutely took to skiing. I loved it at an early age. So it was always my dream to be honest, I think I always just wanted to be a good skier when I was young. I didn't really look at the competition side of it too much. But then there was a race league at the Afford Dry Ski Slope, and I really found my competitive side. My dad always reminds me when I didn't make it into the team on my first attempt. So he found me crying at the bottom of the slopes at the age of, I think I was nine or 10 years old. So at that point, I had this ambition, I really wanted to get into that team. So the real appetite for it. So I, I managed to get into team, and then I went up and up the ranks. I definitely had the bug for ski racing. It went really well. I got into the Scottish team, the British children's team, the British senior team. And then, like I said, I went up the ranks and I was really, really enjoying it. At that time as well, I was going through school. So I actually went out to Canada, because a lot of my friends went to Austrian ski school. So they were there doing the Austrian schooling system, as well as managing to get every morning on skis. Because in ski racing, and to be honest, it's the same as flying, it's all about time in the air, time in the skis, time in the snow, to really get that finesse on the ski and to be able to be as quick as possible. So because of that, but I didn't have the chance to do it, or I didn't want to do that, and my parents didn't want me to do that. They wanted me to get an education back in Scotland. And also I really wanted to be a pilot, like I said before, mm. it was very much an early dream of mine, or an early ambition. So everything was kind of gearing towards that, but the ski racing, and especially because my skiing was getting faster, I was getting to a point where I was getting recognized and I was getting somewhere on the British scene. Like I said, I went into Canada and actually did a bit of ski school out there at the same time, my standard grade. So, the same as that's the Scottish equivalent of the GCSEs. And yeah, I managed to do some skiing in the morning and then schooling in the afternoon. Not much schooling, to be fair. Most of it in the aircraft trip on the way home. But it was all a case of, yeah, getting the schooling done, getting that tick in the box so I could get my grades to be able to go and, yeah, go towards the Armed Careers, Armed Forces Careers Office and say, hello, this is me. I want to join as a pilot. So, yeah, that was, you know, that was my kind of career with the skiing. And then I, at the same time, or actually, I guess it was about 4 months before, I managed to get into the British senior team, which was, you know, fantastic for me. So I'd made it in the skiing scene and made it onto the British team. And that's where I always want to be. You know, I was amongst the likes of Alan Baxter, who you maybe remember from the press, who, mm-hmm. you know, was just an awesome skier, like the best athlete I have ever met to date, you know, by far. There was his brother, Noel Baxter, Finlay Mickle, who, you know, it was me and him. We were the downhill guys, the speed guys. And then Emma Carrick-Anderson, a good friend of mine. She was the slalom skier. And then Shemi Alcott as well, who was the top British female skier for a while. So, you know, I was there. I was amongst all these guys and, you know, I was skiing my heart out to try and get as fast as possible. But then because I'd applied at OASC and got the flying scholarship and then gone back to apply again. But then when I went to apply the second time, I said, oh, actually, I want to go straight in as a pilot, as a direct entrant. I don't want to go to university. I want to start flying as soon as possible. So, yeah, with that, it actually, well, luckily, they accepted me. So I got my offer of acceptance to start initial officer training when I was going through my British, my first full-time British skiing season with the team. So obviously, at that point, it was a very hard decision because I'd actually got somewhere in the British skiing, but then at the same time, being offered a position, you know, initial officer training to then go onwards to become a pilot. So at that point, it was very hard. But at the end of the day, I thought, well, you know what? I'll try and go for the officer training because that's what I've always wanted to do. And with the ski racing, let's face it, there's not a lot of money in it. And actually, you know, my parents just about went bankrupt trying to keep me ski racing. And that kind of coincided about the same time. I just went, you know what? I've just got to go and, yeah, get a job. Yeah. But, you know, let's face it, it was the best job, you know, I'd ever wanted. And in my eyes, it really was the best job in the world and still is, actually. So it was an easy decision, but a hard decision at the same time, really. So I got into the Air Force. I started officer training. I got through it successfully. And at the end of it, there was a few people that started contacting me saying, it was a Flight Lieutenant Mike Waring, and I remember it very well because I was very like, oh, yes, sir, three bags full, sir, because I was still in that officer training mode. Just, he's now a very good mate of mine, always takes the piss out of me for that. And he said, oh, hey, Roger, we heard you're a bit of a skier. Could you come join the RAF ski team? And I was like, yeah, of course. I want to get skiing as much as I can. That'd be awesome. So I joined the RAF ski team about 3 months after I finished officer training. And then I did well at the initial champs. And because obviously I'd come from what was effectively a professional, you know, skiing background to then into amateur with the Air Force. And then going on to continue to compete against the rest of the Air Force and then the Army and the Navy as well and into services. And to do that, actually, I had to push back my flying training to so that I could help the RAF ski team beat the Army and the Navy.
Get your priorities right.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And hey, it gave me a chance to ski, so it was like best of both worlds. So although I remember it very well because the Air Force guys were all, you know, the ski team guys were just trying to play mind games with the Army. So they said, Rog, right, we know you can ski, and, you know, to be honest, at that point, I've been skiing with them for about 3 months. So they're all very good mates of mine. Well, I say 3 months, but, you know, probably about 5 weeks on and off at that point. So at that point, they said, oh, Rog, yet. We just want you to do things like just ski around like a punter, like you don't know what you're doing, like fall over a few times. And when you're inspecting the course, like, you know, fall over and just make it look like you don't know what you're doing. So I followed their instructions and had a bit of a laugh. And I remember the first kind of qualifying run, so it didn't count as the race in the downhill. And I pushed out the start gate and tripped over my pole on purpose, I may add, well, this time, tripped over the pole and, you know, did a few stupid things and then got down to the bottom. And I was 5 seconds ahead of the next army guy and winning the race by 5 seconds. And these three army guys just stood over in the corner about 20 meters away from me with their arms crossed, just kind of shaking their head, just muttering, you know, towards each other. And they never came to say hello at all. But it turned out that, you know, weeks later that they were best mates of mine and we all got on like an absolute ball. And, you know, it was just a case of trying to wind up the army because that's what they'd always done to us as well, the Air Force. So I'd been told.
What happened on that journey then that led you ultimately to write this book?
Yeah, so it was actually one of the big things that happened to me was breaking my leg. And that was just what turned out to be 10 months before the Olympics in 2006. So I had actually been doing really well. To be honest, in my head, I guess it's maybe my self-confidence, but I didn't think I would have been doing so well. And I got to a point where I was third in the North American Cup over in Lake Louise in Canada. And that was my best ever result. You know, I was out of the rankings. I was I wasn't even seeded for that race. And I came down and a couple of training runs. I'd done okay, but I was nowhere near third position. And then I finished the race, the actual competition run, and I crossed my line, crossed the finish line. I remember hearing the commentator say almost like a gasp, and then all I heard was third. And I looked at the scoreboard, and I see a three, and then I see my time next to it. And I'm literally there gawping. And then I see the next thing I see, there was quite a bit of a crowd because it was quite a big race in Canada. And I see the guy who was third, and they had these podiums set up in the snow, and the guy kind of dropping his head and walking off. And I was like, no way. I couldn't believe that that actually happened. And I got third and I qualified for the Olympics right there and then. So that was fantastic for me. But Saw's Law, about 2 months later, I ended up breaking my left leg. So I had a really nasty crash in a FIS race with the Federation International Skiing, and it was in Arbor in Germany. And it was a classic ski racing fall where I fell on my side, and there had been a lot of snowfall the night before, but it was very icy underneath that fresh snow. But for racing, they can't leave the fresh snow on top because otherwise it just gets rutted up. So they slip it off the side of the course, and they slip it as far as they can. But in this case, it wasn't really far enough. So I slipped onto my hip and hit the ice that was underneath this fresh snow that had been slipped off, and just accelerated towards this bank of snow with my leg straight. I hit the bank of snow, my leg hyperextended and then twisted. And then I rolled over a few times as it went to spasm. And what happened is my femur punched into the tibia plateau and crushed it like you would crush honeycomb. So it was pretty nasty and it was pretty sore at the same time, that's for sure. But annoyingly, not sore enough to black me out to make me go unconscious. But yeah, and it was very interesting going down in the blood wagon down to the bottom as well. That's for sure. It was definitely a painful experience. But from that, it turned out that I really damaged my tibial plateau. I'd completely smashed it. It took them a while to actually figure out what was wrong with my leg, and they had to go in with arthroscopy to figure out what was actually going on inside my leg. And in the end, they've just figured out that, the bone was missing because it had been crushed from the femur. So they had to take bone from my pelvis and rebuild the top of the tibial plateau and then use a scaffolding technique of 9 pins and a titanium metal plate and use that to rebuild my leg. So the surgeon effectively told me that I would never ski again, that I would, well, never competitively ski again. I think he actually said never ski again. And then he said that I would always walk with a limp just due to the nature of my injury. So you can imagine at this point, this was before I'd started my flying training, and it was 10 months before I was, or I had already qualified for Olympics. So I was absolutely gutted. I remember going into the, you know, the toilet cubicles in this, the surgery where this guy, Andy Walker, who's an awesome surgeon, by the way, told me this really bad news. And I broke down into tears. I just couldn't believe it, that I'd maybe lost all my skiing hopes and all my flying hopes at the same time.
The book is a fascinating journey of how you recover. And we've already talked a little bit about some of the challenges mentally in terms of some of the flying challenges, particularly with the complex aircraft like the Typhoon. But there are some other things that came into your life as well. And the book is dedicated to the memory of your mum. Tell us a little bit about, I suppose, some of the challenges you had to deal with through that period regarding mental health issues.
So I was going through IF Valley, like I said before, as a QFI. And it was at the point where I had been instructing for only about 2 or 3 months. But, you know, aside that, just completely out of the blue, I got a phone call and I was told that my mum had killed herself. And now, like I said, with this, it was completely out of the blue. It was completely unexpected. Now, my mum had never been diagnosed with any form of mental illness. I guess looking back with hindsight, we always knew that, you know, she possibly suffered from depression or from something. And actually, I had, in a couple of instances, tried to persuade her to go and see someone about what I, you know, maybe thought was a problem. I just wanted her to communicate it. And even, you know, at that age and that time in my life where I never knew anything about mental health, you know, I never would have, you know, said anything like I am these days when it comes to the stigma. And I tried to, you know, to tell her that, yeah, she should probably go and see someone. But I remember her clearly telling me that it was very difficult for her because, you know, when it came to telling, I mean, the way that she said it, it wasn't as if we would put a brand on it like mental health. She just said, I don't want to go and tell anyone how I feel because it'll be like telling the person that I, you know, work with every single day, you know, the one of the doctors there that I'm not quite, you know, I'm not feeling right in my head and I just want to get on with my job was effectively the answer that she gave me. So, you know, from everything that happened there, from having to cope with that grief, but not just, you know, on my behalf, but and having to deal with everything that my sisters, you know, I've got two sisters, so we all had to really pull together and deal with this horrible loss and something that we just didn't expect at all. So from that, you know, day onwards, especially after I got over the grief, I realized that there was such a stigma to mental health. And I remember that conversation with my mom, and I remember thinking, I've just got to make a difference. I will do anything, absolutely anything, you know, in my power to make a difference. Because I really, truly believe that if she had felt comfortable to go and speak to someone, to anyone about, you know, the way she was feeling in her head, then she would still be with us today.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not as if I know, for example, you know, with a lot of people, it is their decision. They make the decision to commit suicide, to take their own life. And we have to sometimes respect the decision, whether we like it or not. But I just feel, you know, there's a lot of cases out there where people are making an ill-informed decision. You know, they're not really truly aware of why they're feeling the way they are. So my, and like I was saying before, it's not as if I have a doctorate or, you know, or any sort of qualification when it comes to psychology, but I've been through it and I really know about mental illness because I guess in a form I've had to deal with things, you know, like I've been talking about through the, you know, the ups and downs of flying training, for example, of ski racing. But then also with, you know, mental illness and definitely with my mum when I look back. And then obviously having to cope with it myself, you know, afterwards as well. So that's where I feel like I definitely have some experience. And you know, they do say that 4 in 1 people suffer from a mental health illness, and that's why we really need to make it to the forefront of people's minds, because I think we value our bodies far more than we value our minds, you know, in this day and age. It's just, for example, it's talking about our mental health hygiene, our emotional hygiene. You know, like if we're a wee kid, we just get taught, don't we, if we cut our leg that we need to put a plaster on it. You know, if we graze our knee, we're like, oh, you know, mum, I want a plaster. I need to sort this out. But when it comes to your mental health, if you were to say you're lonely, then you're like, oh, well, come on here, you know, come on here, just, you know, just come and talk to me. Or if you say you've got a fear of failure or something like that, there's just no process to really teach you about that and to teach you how to get over it and how to, or not just get over, I guess, but how to learn about these things and learn how to cope with them. So I think we need to, as a culture, as a nation, you know, even in the world, really, let's think big picture, because everyone's talking about mental health, which is great, but it's not just about talking about it. It's about how do we actually tackle this? And I think it is getting into schools and getting people to think about their emotional hygiene. You know, how do they tackle situations where they have to cope with failure? They have to cope with, maybe being lonely, being isolated, and just having to deal with these mental health problems, I think is what I'm trying to get across.
Roger, I mean...
go on, Tim, sorry.
All right, okay. You know, I think, you know, thanks first off for kind of sharing with this with us, you know, obviously a sensitive issue. And you know, I'm just sat here sort of, you know, kind of open-mouthed really at some of the stuff, sharing with us. But, I mean, what I'm asking in one sense, in the pilot community, in the civil world, there's been a lot of emphasis recently on mental health. You think of German Wings, you think of MH370. From the military aviation side of the house, you know, we've come a long way since the Second World War and lack of moral fibre in World War II, you know, Bomber Command. Yeah. Is there still a stigma there in the forces, and particularly, you know, your job is the type A personality, the fighter pilot, the Tom Cruise, sunglasses, yeah, shades, confidence.
Yeah. Absolutely, you know, yeah, absolutely. And
can I just add one part onto that, so you can maybe, yeah, that deal with the whole thing in one go, if you like.
Yeah.
Presumably, particularly with the role that you have, which is not to denigrate the role that anyone else in the Air Force has got, but you're fighter pilots, you're defending the shores of the UK. It's important to the Air Force and the country that you guys and girls are all turning up at work every day with a positive mental attitude and all those kinds of things. And I was just wondering whether that is something that is... what's the right way of putting it? Yeah, does the Air Force attach any importance to that? Is it something you talk about at work, or do you know what I mean? Well,
yeah, absolutely. And you know what? I had my departure interview with the station commander at IF Lossiemouth, and he's, you know, we were talking about this and how mental health, because as you know, that I've been raising money with this book, and I've actually been raising awareness and money for the stigma, or trying to really get people to combat the stigma against mental health for the last, 5 years, really, ever since my mom took her own life. So from that, I've been talking about it for a lot. So everyone kind of knows that. So I think everyone knows that about me as a fighter pilot, you know, someone on a frontline squadron. But you're quite right. You're absolutely right in that it is a case of, just get on with it, you know, just suck it up. And there's still a bit of that. But you know what? I enjoy trying to get people to talk about their mental health. Now, I don't go around going, oh, tell me how you feel, because I'm not that kind of guy. I'm not going to get people to hug trees and that sort of thing. And I'm not saying that it comes down to that either, but I'm saying that if I talk about it, if I talk about my mental health, and if I, you know, ask people to tell me potentially maybe what they've gone through, or to share similar circumstances. You know, for example, I think if there would be a time where I couldn't tell people that I had, you know, nearly had my chop ride when I went through Linton News, when I was going through flying training there, because it gives you a stage of, oh, well, he's weak. Oh, if he was bad, you know, if he made mistakes back then, he can make mistakes now. And then, you know, there's times like that when you go through flying training where you realize that there is a bit of a bravado. There's a bit of like, oh, yeah, well, yeah, this guy, he's all over it. He's absolutely, you know, an incredible pilot. But then as I grew older and wiser, more gray hairs, more experienced with the jets especially, then I started to realize, and I saw it in everyone, that everybody made a mistake, you know, almost every single flight. And it used to give me that confidence, that buzz every time I saw someone else make a mistake. That's bad, isn't it? But I would look at other people and go, oh, okay, you're human. And I look at the next one, and, you know, say a person who I thought was an incredible pilot, and I saw them make a mistake. I'm like, oh, okay, that's interesting. And of course, it just gave me this sense of like, okay, right, here we go. We're all human. And especially after losing my mom, it gave me a whole new perspective on life. Again, that maybe sounds a bit cheesy, but I think it really did, because it made me look at things very differently. It made me reframe how I look at what I do in my life and what I aim, you know, to try and get the best out of people as well. When it comes to, you know, flying, especially as a QFI, or it just comes to working with people on the squadrons I have done. And I think it is, yeah, it's really important to get that vibe out there about mental health and how we should just feel comfortable. If we get to a day where we're like, you know what, this is not my day. I just don't think I should fly. You know, it is the question that we always ask before we go flying is, and this is from the authorizer, and we always ask ourselves as well, is, are we fit to fly? And that shouldn't just come down to, oh, well, actually, my sinuses are completely blocked. I just cannot go fly. I won't be able to clear my ears, which is always a good excuse to use if you're going to fly with an instructor you don't like. or you can...
Essential tips here on the show, folks.
Yeah, yeah. You heard it here. But it should come to the same as mental, you know, health, where you just get to a point where you're just not feeling it. And I know that can be a bit vague, but sometimes people just know if you have, you know, one person who pulls that, you know, once a week, then okay, maybe we have to look at that differently, or maybe that person has to go and get help and actually try and tackle it properly. But at least it raises that question, and it gets people speaking about their mental health. I think that's the main thing.
Roger, the book Speed of Sound, Sound of Mind is out now, and you are supporting Help for Heroes, amongst other things, aren't you?
That's right, yeah. We are supporting Help for Heroes and also the Scots Association of Mental Health. So we are all the money that we're raising, and I think we're about close to £5,000 now. We're giving 50-50 split to both those charities. And I say we're actually, it's myself. I wrote the book with Donald McNaughton. And just a quick bit on him was that we met when I was going through my skiing, when I broke my leg, like I said before. I met this this crazy Norwegian psychologist who told me that I had gremlins in my leg, et cetera, et cetera. And I didn't really feel that. And it wasn't really the way my mind was working, and it kind of put me off sports psychologists for forever. But then I was mandated to go and meet this guy, Donald McNaughton. So it literally was a case of, okay, if I have to, drove up to Inverness, met this guy, got on like a house on fire, and he really, really helped me. And he's probably the reason why I've wrote this book in the first place, is because he helped me really harness the power of my mind and appreciate what it can do just by being positive. So we wrote this book together. Long story short, we always stayed in touch. And then I kind of got in touch with him and said, I've got this idea. I want to raise awareness of mental health. I want to fight the stigma, like I was speaking about before. And he's completely on board. He's done a fantastic job himself of psychology with athletes. But he's taken that into this book with me to really try and show people, you know, what they can do with using the power of their mind and staying positive.
Where can we find the book, Roger? How can we get hold of a copy?
Yeah, sure. Well, you can either get it online. We've got it on sale at Amazon. So if you just search for the title of the book, like you said, Speed of Sound, Sound of Mind, and you can find it there. You can download it there. So that'll work for Kindle or for any device, really. You can download when there are apps, so you're able to read it on any device. However, we do now have it just recently out in paperback, which I think it only came out about a month ago. So we've taken in a massive order of that, and actually I'm selling them out or posting them out myself, so which is it's fortunately kept me really busy. I didn't think they'd be selling so quickly. So we got an initial batch of about 250. We're nearly through those. So so yeah, it's going really well. So you can donate at justgiving.com/soundofmind, and that's for Help for Heroes, or to get a paperback, you can donate at justgiving.com/speedofsound, and that's for Sam H. Or for Help for Heroes, it's justgiving.com/soundofmind. And then if you just message me on my Facebook site, which is facebook.com/speedofsound2016, and you can like the page, send me a message, and I will, of course, send you a paperback as quick as I can.
Will you sign those for anyone who wants that?
Oh, of course, yeah, that would be wonderful. My pleasure, absolutely. And I'll make sure Dawn signs it as well, so we both do that for you, yeah.
Brilliant. Well, if you send us the links, we'll put those in the show notes for people to link directly to. I know I will be getting a copy of that. Can't wait to get
you
through that. So please do send us those links and we'll put them in there. Roger, just as Tim and Gareth said, thank you very much for your openness and honesty in that interview. It was very sobering.
No, thank you very much. And again, like I said, thank you very much for having me on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure.
No, it's been fantastic. We know you've got a very, very young baby very close by, but please do stick around if you can for a bit longer. We've still got lots to get through, but we appreciate if you do need to go.
Not another flying magazine. The news agents are stuffed with them. How can the aviation historian possibly be any different from the rest? Well, for a start, it's not a monthly, but a quarterly. It's compact format, not the usual A4, so it's great for reading in bed, in the bog, or in the bath. It doesn't cover the same old subjects, but tells you stuff you didn't already know. It's designed simply so it's easier to read, with no fussy backgrounds or overlapping images. And it's not in the newsagents at all. So check the website, theaviationhistorian.com, for more info. The Aviation Historian. It really is different from the rest.
Find this and other great shows at the Aviation Media Network.
TheVoicesInYourHead.com.
Okay, and for this episode of Extended, we welcome author, journalist, and commercial airline pilot Owen Zupp, who this summer has published a fascinating new book, Without Precedent, about his late father, Philip Zupp, telling his life story from World War II commando, Korean War fighter pilot, to flying for the Australian Royal Flying Doctor Service. It's a fantastic read for aviation buffs and history types, as well as those people who've got a quiet, unassuming member of the greatest generation in their family and wonder, what do they really do during the war? Owen, a very big welcome to Extended.
Thanks, Tim. It's great to be here.
Now, Owen, to start off, I've read the book, obviously. What is Without Precedent about?
You've probably drawn a very good thumbnail sketch there. It's about my father's life, and in summary, he was a rural lad who grew up somewhat disadvantaged by the times, the Great Depression, etc., which forced him to leave school, also the loss of their farm. And as a consequence, he didn't have the education he might have dreamed of and subsequently couldn't chase his dreams, that of becoming a pilot. But through one thing and another, he went via the Air Training Corps and the Army during World War II, etc. He persevered and actually finally followed his dream and became a pilot just prior to the Korean War. And from there, he became a military pilot and a civil pilot and had an extended career in aviation, which ended up with around 23,000 hours and around 100 different aircraft types. So in a nutshell, a chap who grew up in the country in difficult times and followed his dreams.
Fantastic. What was the inspiration that you know, kind of set you off on writing Without Precedent? I mean, you've been writing for a bit beforehand. So you know, I suppose in a sense my question is, why did it take you a while to get round to him?
I actually started writing this as the very first work that I ever commenced.
Oh, right, okay.
But yes, it took a number of years. I guess probably the reason that occurred was, whereas other works I had written, when I got to a certain level, I was happy that story had been encapsulated. I had enough detail. But when you're writing about someone who's so close to you, every time you peel a layer of the onion back, you're actually peeling a layer of your own family history back. And you don't tend to stop. You tend to want to delve a bit deeper, particularly when you're trying to examine who your father was in a lifetime prior to you even existing. And for that reason, there always seemed to be another veteran coming out of the woodwork or another record emerging from the archives or some other tale or photograph. And for that reason, there were periods where it almost struck, I won't say a brick wall, but there was a definite pause. And so whilst it was the most recent work I've completed, in all honesty, it was the first story I ever commenced. And it was only now after a number of years that I felt that I had the story really down. So there's been a lot of time invested into this book, more so than any other work I've done.
Okay, so your father had a very humble, tough upbringing in rural Australia. Tell our listeners about that. What do you think that contributed to his character?
I think it contributed in a number of ways. I think you've hit a very good point there. He initially, they had a lovely farm, lovely farmhouse, etc. But with the onset of the Great Depression, and similarly in Australia, there was a drought. They lost that property. And he had to move on to less ideal land, leave school, and actually have a job where he worked inside furnaces cleaning the carbon off the inner linings. Now, that was a fairly harsh upbringing, as well as driving cattle from the time he was 10 years of age. Where I think it contributed was, in a holistic sense, it taught him perseverance and not to expect anything. But in his time in New Guinea as a commando, etc., he had a degree of resilience and just fundamentally a tough young man by the nature of his surroundings. And I think when there was adversity in his career, be it physically by his environment and his surroundings, or mentally in the terms of the challenges, I think he was very well prepared by virtue of that upbringing.
I mean that brings me on to my next question about your father's time in the Army Commandos. I mean, that was the kind of tail end of World War II in New Guinea, but even though Japan was close to defeat, it was still pretty dangerous, wasn't it?
It was. In fact, a number of the veterans I spoke to told me about firefights that occurred after the surrender, and there are some mentioned in the book. However, I've limited the anecdotes as such to those which I could find documentary evidence for. So there were a number of firefights after the surrender, actually, with the Japanese that aren't mentioned in the book by virtue of the fact that I couldn't find that evidence. But yes, it was still very much a dangerous time. There were booby traps. They were setting booby traps, and they were encountering pockets of resistance at all times.
And post-war, he was stationed in occupied Japan, including Hiroshima. He'd still got his, a kind of a flying manual, a flying book, and obviously encountered the source of P-51 Mustangs, at that point. How did he get back into flying from the Army?
Well, he came back and he had a somewhat restless time after he arrived home from Japan. It was nearly 2 years after the war had finished by the time he got home. And he initially was cutting cane, which was hard work but very good pay, but he still hadn't lost that dream of flying. He re-enlisted in the Air Force, but as a mechanic, and then learnt to fly civilly on Tiger Moths at a flying school. And that was what, in turn, I think, gave him enough impetus to get recruited or remustered as an Air Force pilot, because he didn't have the education by any shape or form to be recruited as a military pilot, but on the recommendation of a commanding officer, in combination with his marks as a mechanic and his initiative to learn to fly privately, I think those three things combined to allow him to be remustered as a pilot within the Air Force.
And the story then moves on. He's kind of going to go through flight training and eventually ends up in the Korean War flying kind of Gloster Meteors. And when we think of jets in Korea, we actually think F-86 Sabre, MiG-15. But one of the most interesting things was the description of the Gloster Meteor in action with the Royal Australian Air Force, which a lot of people overlook. What was his impression of the jet?
Well, just on the note of the Sabre, everyone in the mess used to sing a song, "All I Want for Christmas Is My Wings Swept Back." But his impression of the Meteor, he liked it. He recognised it was early generation compared to aircraft like the Sabre. But when it found its role, which they used it in ground attack, it was reasonably well suited. It was when it tried to mix it with the MiGs at altitude that it was found wanting. But he found the aircraft a good, stable gun platform. It did tend to fishtail a little bit on occasions, I remember him saying to me, but fundamentally it could take a fair amount of abuse from ground fire, a stable gun platform, which in a ground attack role was what you wanted, although it did have that blaring vulnerability that it did have a belly-mounted fuel tank.
That was a bit of an eye-opener as well. I mean... flying the Meteor in the ground attack realms, seems pretty risky. The fuel tank on the underside, and yet, it comes out that your father seemed very sort of tenacious in pressing home his attacks. Being the last one in, reattacking, and got away with it. Flew 201 combat missions. I mean, what do you think was his secret to his survival?
I think luck, and I think he would probably be the first to admit that. In terms of the tenacity of the attacks, that is something that I found intriguing as I peeled the layers of that onion back and spoke to more and more veterans, because they all said the same thing. Whereas they would use a jinking approach to the target, he had a preference to be last over the target, and he had a preference to fly straight in at the target. And they admitted, they said it was a rather high-risk form of attack. But he once did say to me, though, that what he did was he would watch where the shots landed from the preceding aircraft, and if they went long, he could ascertain that there was a tailwind, etc. So he preferred being last on target because it gave him some previous hits and misses to let him know what the environmental conditions were. But I think he would be the first to admit that in any form of combat per se, the importance of luck is huge.
And, talking of luck, it was in Korea that he was unusually awarded a U.S. Purple Heart Medal, a close call, a very close call indeed, turned his Meteor into a convertible. And that sort of, seems to have caused all sorts of diplomatic upsets and bureaucratic to and froing. What's the story behind this, and has it now been resolved?
Yeah, it's a very interesting story that's got phone calls occurring even now in 2016. What had happened fundamentally, and this is once again something that as I delved deeper I found out more and more, one of his squadron mates had been shot down. He was called in on the target to try and locate the parachute. And against the snow, that was obviously very difficult. He made one run. Whilst his leader flew up to the other aircraft that were overhead. He couldn't sight it. He was then dispatched to try and lead in other aircraft. In amongst the ground fire, he couldn't locate those other aircraft, so he returned to the search area again. So he effectively flew through the ground fire around three times. He thought he sighted a red scarf on the snow, and just as he banked back to locate that, the ground fire finally got a bead on him and blew his canopy off and wounded him in the face, blew his oxygen mask askew, and his goggles, which I still have, were shattered. When he arrived, as you quite rightly said, as a convertible with the top down and no canopy, it seems that the Americans were somewhat impressed by this, and the paperwork battle, so to speak, to award him the Purple Heart began. It's unique in that it is only reserved for American servicemen. And that is where the diplomatic wrangling began, because it was recommended by the United States. It was recommended by the Commander-in-Chief of the occupation forces. It was also recommended by the Australian Prime Minister's Office and the Governor-General. It just got held up in a bureaucratic chain, it would appear. But as to where it is now, it is actually being investigated again, because some people have read the book who have some influence, and we might have to rewrite that last chapter, it seems. For one way or the other, we might have some final closure on the issue.
Fantastic. It's an amazing story, and I love the fact that we awarded one pilot a Purple Heart, and what kind of can of worms this might open, that somebody's kind of worried about. Anyway, so moving to kind of post-war, I mean, one of the interesting things, I think, as well as the kind of combat flying, is your father's career seems almost like a mini history of Australian aviation. You know, there's a bit of World War Two. There's Korea, post-war airlines, and the famous Flying Doctor service. So where do you think he was most at home?
I would have to say in civil operations. It would have to have been in the air ambulance operation out of Sydney, which was the last job he had prior to retirement for around 10 years. It was single pilot, well-maintained aircraft, and a real sense of camaraderie in a small unit. And I can still remember being a schoolboy and hearing the phone ring at 2 in the morning to call him to go to the airport, and him walking down to the front gate whistling. whereas most people being called at 2 o'clock in the morning would be cursing. He would go down to that gate whistling, and when he'd be coming back pre-dawn, I could hear him at altitude going over the house, and he would get the propellers intentionally out of synchronization, so it would make a warbling sound. So I'd be in my bed at 5 o'clock in the morning, and I'd hear this wah, 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 wah. And I'd know it was bad coming back home. He used to do the same thing over my school as well.
Brilliant. One of the remarkable things, actually, of the 100 types he's got in his logbook, but at the back of the book you also make a list of all the aircraft he flew, and incredibly there's many of them still around in one way or the other, in museums, as gate guards, on pylons. The first Tiger Moth he flew is still airworthy, is that right?
The aircraft he went first solo in the military, from recollection, he flew Tiger Moths civilly when he trained, but from recollection, it is the first Tiger Moth he flew solo in the RAAF. Yes, it's still around.
Amazing. From his logbook, he's got Tiger Moth, Wirraway, DC-3, Queen Airs. Was there any aircraft it was his favourite? He seems to have a special affinity for the Mustang.
Yeah, absolutely. It was the Mustang, and then probably Daylight second. He is the Mustang. The Mustang he spoke about, and he wasn't a very emotive character, but I could tell that the Mustang did stir emotions in him.
And, you know, you're a commercial pilot yourself, over 17,000 hours under your belt, is that right?
It's coming up. I probably haven't updated that. It's getting closer to 20.
What was one of the most surprising things you found out about your father's life? What was the biggest lesson, perhaps as a professional pilot, that you might draw from his experiences?
Look, I think as a professional pilot, I was also fortunate that he is my flight instructor for all my training except for my flight instructor rating. So he taught me privately, commercially, instrument rating, multi-engine, etc. And I think the greatest lesson, and there were many, was probably that you never perfect being a pilot, but the days you get close are kind of satisfying.
Yeah.
And that the day you think you know it all, that's when you're dangerous. So I've tried to model my career along those lines, that even now as I drive home, I try to do a silent review of what I could have done better that day. And that was something I saw in him, that despite all his experience on all the types and even combat experience, he never for a moment thought that he was a master aviator or had the game beat, as he'd say. He was always looking to learn or improve, and that is something I try to follow, or an ethos that I try to follow myself.
That's fascinating, kind of the idea of lifelong learning, because I think that also kind of comes out in you know, sort of Sully Sullenberger's book and kind of, you know, sort of interviews with him about how it's, again, you know, you never know too much, you know. It's always, no. You know. So, I mean, I personally love the book myself. Really fascinating read. Loved it. What's been the wider critical and reader reaction?
It's been phenomenal. It caught me a little off guard because there was obviously an element of personal passion to write this story, and it took a long time. Initially, I wrote it from the first person, but it did have that ring of my dad to it, so I removed myself from the book and wrote it somewhat remotely. And the fact that it's touched people right around the world, literally, is amazing because he'd be horrendously embarrassed. he was a very, very shy and quiet person. As you said, tenacious, but very quiet. And the reaction has been phenomenal. On Amazon, the reviews have been rolling in, and they've all been positive. The only one that wasn't a 5-star was a 4-star, and it was still a glowing review, and it was actually by another Korean veteran who said, this book is historically correct and reminded me of my own times. And that meant probably as much to me as any review could mean, because there was another Meteor pilot who'd been there, done that, has found the book and said it's historically accurate, because that's what I endeavoured to achieve. I wanted to write an entertaining story, but I did not want to diverge from the facts, because in my opinion the facts were entertaining in their own right.
And what about your kind of reaction, I suppose, from your own family? I mean, don't know, sons, daughters, or maybe uncles that you know, this is the kind of Philip Zupp that they didn't know.
Yes, it's been a voyage of discovery, I think, for friends, family alike. As I said, he was a very quiet chap who, even when they found fragments of shrapnel and perspex in his face in 1990, which was left over from the Korean War, when the nurses and doctors were inquiring, they said, oh, how could this have happened? He said, oh, it's a fair while ago now. He didn't bother delving into the fact that he had his canopy blown off. He just sort of said, oh, that's a while ago now, you know. And that's who he was. And I think that made the story both remarkable and at times difficult to write. But I think the voyage of discovery for every family member and friend has been somewhat satisfying, because they all knew little bits and they all had suspicions.
Yeah.
But by being able to draw out the records and the anecdotes of other people, we did get a fuller picture of who he was, and it made it even more remarkable that he had done so much, and he was so loath to share it, and
yeah,
he was just a shy, unassuming person. I was fortunate that he cracked the door for me, mainly through those years when he taught me to fly.
Yeah, okay. So you've done a fabulous, you know, a book, you know, without precedent. I'm sure, you know, your father today would be very proud, even if you say he might be a little bit embarrassed. But what's your next writing project? What are you working on at the moment?
It's multi-pronged, to be perfectly honest. I've got a series of books called The Practical Pilot, which are practical guides for private pilots, student pilots. Rather than a textbook, they're just talking about practical aspects, how to go about flying with friends, tips for landing and takeoff, etc. And I've got a huge demand from people to write volume 3. So the demand is dictating that. And the passion is probably behind writing my mother's story now, because believe it or not, she had, I won't say an equally remarkable story, but a remarkable story in a different way, in that she was a World War II radar operator. Her first love was killed in Lancasters over Europe. Her subsequent fiancé was killed in a Beaufort bomber in New Guinea. And that she went on, finally met my father in 1951 as he dispatched for Korea. and they were married within knowing each other, probably 100 hours in each other's company. So she had a very interesting life for a woman in those years. But there's also a very deep story of love and loss. There's also an incredible number of coincidences. You may recall that Dad crawled over Beaufort bombers in New Guinea as a commando.
Yes,
One of those bombers is in the Australian War Memorial. And that was one of the bombers that my mother's fiancé had flown, and he was in when it crash-landed before it was pushed into the jungle. Now, I went down to look at that bomber at the War Memorial, and the jet that my father flew his first combat mission in was parked beside it.
How bizarre.
So first fiancé who was killed, the aircraft he predominantly flew is in the Australian War Memorial, and the jet that my father flew his first combat mission is in the Australian War Memorial. So Mum has a remarkable story in a different way, possibly a broader audience. I think women would really identify with this story. But to put it in a nutshell, Practical Pilot Volume 3 and My Mother's Story.
Brilliant. Well, we look forward to reading those in the future then. So, finally, it's been fantastic to have you on the show. Just the final thing now is, where can we find you on social media or online, and where can our listeners pick up Without Precedent?
I'm at owenzopp.com. That is owenzupp.com. That's my base as such on the internet. I'm also on Twitter as Owenzupp and Facebook as Owenzupp Author. And in terms of the book, it's on all the digital outlets as an e-book, Amazon, iTunes, etc. And it is available at specialist bookstores, although that's starting to grow into more mainstream bookstores now. And if they don't have it, they can order it because it's on all the databases they can order it in. But it is growing in popularity, and mainline bookstores are actually starting to pick it up as well. So it's a slow momentum building in terms of that. But online, in the digital form, it's gone incredibly well right around the world.
Great stuff. Well, it's a really good book. I recommend it to everyone. If you're an aviation buff, if you're not an aviation buff, you should really read that. Owen, great to talk to you.
Thanks, Tim. It's been very good to chat to you.
Tim Owen, fascinating guy. His father, 23,000 hours, 100 aircraft types. But he didn't even start his career till later on, having been a commando. Fascinating man.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. His kind of life sort of reads like a little bit like a potted history of sort of Australia, recent Australian aviation, if you like, kind of World War II, obviously in the commandos there, Korean War, flying Gloster Meteors, then the sort of airlines, sort of post-war, flying things like DC-3, and then the Royal Australian Flying Doctor Service. Amazing. Very, very humble guy, very quiet. He's one of the sort of, the greatest generation, I suppose you'd call them, who didn't really sort of talk about it. And then, Owen said that the more he dug into his father's career, the more he found out, and the more and there was people who, his father's friends or people who'd known him, who knew he'd been a commando but didn't know he was a pilot, or knew he was a pilot but didn't know he'd been a commando. Yeah. Incredible story. And I think also it's significant. One of the things that you got out from it was that his father, very, very experienced guy, flown Mustangs, flown the Meteor. But he was a lifelong professional pilot, always wanting to learn more, and having taught Owen that as well, taught Owen to fly as his instructor, always sort of and that also. You mentioned that as well, Roger, about, you've got 650 hours on the Typhoon, and you're still learning it. So I think that's a really important skill there, or a mindset to have, that, as soon as you think you know it all, that's probably usually when you're about to have an accident.
Yeah, that's when you need to stop.
Well, he flew on right to the end. I didn't know, Tim, that meteors that served in the Korea conflict, actually. I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's another thing. I mean, it's interesting from that point of view is you know, that they flew with the Royal Australian Air Force in ground attack, a phenomenally sort of, you know, dangerous occupation. You know, there's a ventral fuel tank that, you know, filled with fuel, that's obviously a nice big target for somebody on the ground to shoot at. And, you know, Owens, Father Philip, you know, was extremely tenacious in pressing on his attacks, low level, you know, kind of last in the line, and wasn't doing any jinking, apparently, according to kind of squadron mates. And the weird thing is, well, not the weird thing is, but the number interesting part of the story is Owens' mum. And
Was his, amazing, wasn't it?
She was in the you know, Royal Australian Air Force as well, and was having these reports coming back from the, you know, the front of Korea, saying about you know, which air crew had been lost and killed, and she was kind of opening them with trepidation. And there'd be, you know, colleagues or people back from the front line who knew Philip, saying, "Oh, he's you know, good on Philip. You won't believe what he's doing, you know, attacking those." And so she apparently was like, "I don't want to hear this," you know. Yeah. And the other thing also as well that and here's a weird coincidence that you know, Owen was telling me about, is that she'd already been involved with two other pilots as fiancés, and one of them had flown a Beaufort and was killed in New Guinea flying a Beaufort, which Philip had found as a wreck in New Guinea.
It's been,
and
it,
both
it was
of these
bizarre,
aircraft are now in the Australian National Museum, National War Museum.
Yeah,
a meteor that Philip flew, and this Beaufort that his fiance, wasn't it?
Yeah, her fiance.
Like a fiance.
Yeah,
incredible.
So how's that for a kind of a spooky coincidence? So yeah, really, really good to chat to Owen. Knows a lot of stuff about flying. Very experienced pilot, and what a story his dad's got.
Yeah, and I can't actually wait for his mum's story. He said, mentioned there that he was going to write his mother's story. It looks fascinating as well. But A Purple Heart for his dad, another fantastic book without precedent, another one to add to the list behind Roger's. So there's still plenty to come. After the break, we're going to get to your feedback and promoting aerospace.
This is Max Flight. I love aviation podcasts. That's why I do Airplane Geeks, the UAV Digest, and the PaxX podcast. But when I need a break from creating my own shows, I turn to Extended. Peter, Tim, and Gareth do a stellar job and bring us all interesting and informative episodes. Extended, a great aerospace program.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
and so to the Get Involved and Feedback section of the show. Gareth hit the nail on the head in the last show when he asked for first aviation memories, and you did tell us, so we're going to run through them all. We're going to pick a few out, but there is a lot to get through, so we'll crack on. Matt Willis, of course, naval air historian, says his first aviation memory: my dad showing me the Airfix Spitfire he'd built as a boy. I knew from that moment that aeroplanes were the best thing in the world. Then he built me a Hurricane. Thanks, Dad. He got to go to Duxford for his birthday too. So well done, Matt. Now, as we record, Matt's just turned 40. So happy birthday, Matt. And his book on the Fairey Barracuda is out next month. It's launched at the Telford Model Show, and we'll put some links in the show notes to that. We'll try and get Matt on the show to talk about that. Okay, moving on. Neil Braden, his first memory was seeing the Red Arrows in the late 70s somewhere in Cornwall. No idea, though. Where? Not quite sure. Sure that it was a good memory or not. Stephen Wood, who's the Woodmeister, of course, seeing the Red Arrows at the closing of RAF Lucca, Malta in the 70s. He was six. They flew proper low then. Glenn Towler from New Zealand, of course, good supporter of the show. His first memory is remember flying the NAC 737-200 from Auckland to Wellington at the age of six, and posted us a photo of that, which we'll put in the show notes. Edward Muller.
Bit young to be a pilot.
Yeah, I'm sure that looks like a postcard, I think. I don't know.
Ah, okay.
Don't know where we credit the author with that one, but... Edward Mullen, at an air show in the early mid-80s, my dad took me up in a small aircraft. I was very terrified. He put something else, but we can't publish that. Jeff says, probably a rainswept Gaydon 16 in 69, four-year-old, got blown over by an F4C as it taxied out through the crowd to depart. Lucky you. good friend of the show, V-Force Rod. SR-71 Blackbird at Greenham Common in 1983. Christine Negroni, she's the author of The Crash Detectives, which is coming out soon on Penguin Books. You can hear a review of that on the Airplane Geeks. The first time I flew in an aeroplane, she was six. It was an Eastern Airlines flight from Miami to Newark, probably a DC-8. She goes on to explain it, and we'll put a full link to her story in the show notes. But she remembers it particularly as a flight attendant strung a cardboard bib in the shape of a teddy bear around her neck with her name and other information printed on it. And off she went. I just can't see that happening these days. Can you?
No.
I can't. I know it does, but I can't. moving on then, Gareth Jones, 1971, two Phantoms departing from RAF Valley and keeping it low. The noise was unbelievable. I was 10, and the rest, they say, is memories are an incredible thing. I remember the black and white checks as well, 43 Squadron. So there you go, many happy memories from RAF Valley. Kevin Dennington, the first NA-39 Buccaneer arriving at Lossiemouth in the early 60s. Don't think we knew the name at that time. Oh, that's an impressive one, isn't it? I miss the Buccaneer, I must say. Stephen Johnson got into aviation through my job as a train driver. My employer named a locomotive called the Chinook. And as part of the deal, they got a tour of RAF Odeum and a training flight on a Chinook. So from that point, he was hooked. Lucky them.
Do helicopters count? Are we including?
Helicopters? Yeah. What are they, those dangerous things that set out to kill us?
Whirlybird.
Yeah, we should allow them. Ed Parsons, his first memory, the making of an Ag Geek Concorde 002 flying over his house. His memory is hazy, running in from the garden thinking the world was about to end because of the noise. So that's probably got to be late 60s. Late 60s, early 70s. Ian Campbell, Lightning XR-724 landing at Binbrook in 92, butting in on my pops, giving a live radio interview. That's Ian from Planes TV. by the way.
Yeah.
Then some of your buddies, Roger, Jamie Norris, good friend of the show, of course, featured on, I think, first or second show we ever produced, actually. His first memory was flying solo for the first time in a glider on his 16th birthday. Apparently, the minimum age now is 14. That's interesting.
Fair play to him for not mentioning the Harrier as well. Well done.
Any chance he gets.
And Flight Lieutenant Mark Long, of course, who was the Typhoon display pilot. His first aviation memory, not closing the canopy in a bulldog and flying for a rain shower. He got soaked. Roger, I'm sure that that doesn't happen
have
very
done,
often,
done that
does it?
Typhoon?
Yeah. I don't think I'll ever try.
Can we get a hat trick of Typhoon pilot first flying memories?
What about you, Roger, then?
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember this well. So I went to Dinant Gliding Strip, which was just outside where I went to school, a Boyne Academy. It was just about 5 minutes down the road. So I hopped on the bus with my sister. So we went there. We had arranged to go for our first flight, really. It was both our first flight. And it was a glorious day. Loch na Garr, obviously, just down the road. And it was just, you know, a beautiful part of the world where I grew up. So I guess I'm biased. But we jumped in and got airborne. And I think I was airborne for about 32 minutes and landed from that. So, you know, we got fairly lucky. I thought I was, you know, done pretty well with that. And the instructor was chuffed. We landed. And my sister was airborne for about an hour and 15. I was so jealous. We stayed in, you know, the overhead of Dinant and the Boyne area, you know, which is really nice. I absolutely love the trip. But my sister had been so high. I mean, she'd gone about 6,000 feet higher than me and all the way over to Loch na Garr and stayed airborne for about an hour 15. So, I remember that very well, being very jealous. But hey, I fly Typhoons now, so I can't complain.
Right, well, let's move on to another friend of the show, Tom Mercer, and his memory was seeing Concorde and the Red Arrows. But let Tom tell you himself.
Having lived for just 5 minutes from RAF Odeum since I was born, aviation has always been a big part of my life. I think my first real aviation memory comes from Farnborough Airshow sometime in the mid-90s. My dad took my sister and I to the show, but we'd left a little later than we should have done, and as a result got caught up in heavy traffic. We could hear lots of aircraft flying around, but we couldn't see a lot of it because we were under trees heading into Ilsmore. All of a sudden it went fairly quiet. A lot of people had turned their engines off because the traffic just wasn't moving, but just moments later the air was filled with the sound of jet engines. I frantically looked out of every side of the car trying to spot what was coming until a large formation flew straight over us. A large white airliner was surrounded by 9 little red aircraft trailing coloured smoke. That's the Red Arrows and Concorde, my dad said. From that moment, I was hooked. We continued to go back to Farnborough every 2 years, but it wasn't really until I went to college and studied photography that I took a serious interest in the industry. My photographic skills continued to develop, and I started attending more air shows with my dad. The two interests just seemed to work together so well. I went to the university to study computer science, but continued studying both photography and aviation in my spare time, until finally I started writing airshow reviews in 2013. To begin with, these were fairly naive, and to be honest, they weren't great, but they were published on my own photography website, and with time and experience, these started to get more comprehensive. I spent the next few years expanding my portfolio by gaining experience in pretty much anything I could get involved with. That's probably a story for another time. But now, almost 3 years later, I've launched Aviation Highlights with great success. Since launching in January this year, I've been fortunate enough to work closely with Boeing UK, the Royal Navy, the Royal Air Force, and JHC. Most recently, just a few weeks ago in fact, the US Air Force. The aim of Aviation Highlights is to cover the biggest industry news items, bring you comprehensive airshow reviews, and produce exclusive in-depth feature articles. The website has had over 27,000 hits, and continues to grow with each day. To say that I'm chuffed with how well this has gone so far is an understatement, but my passion for it can all be traced back to that memory from Farnborough. Hopefully now, I can do my part to help inspire the next generation.
Okay, so a reminder about Tom's new website. That's aviationhighlights.co.uk, and he's avhighlights on Twitter. Go and have a look. He's got some great stuff on there. Apron 6, memory, first aviation memory, Red Arrows at the Ostend Air Show, somewhere halfway in the 90s. He was only a couple of years old. God, he's got a good memory. That was when the Red Arrows travelled abroad, which, of course, they are at the moment as well.
Yeah.
So interesting. Liam at LPM Photography, playing football, and everybody stops playing as a diamond formation of 12 Buccaneers flew low to Lossiemouth.
Oh,
what a great one. Joseph Chung, he tells us a little story. He started to collect a magazine subscription for World Aircraft Information Files, and his magazine collection could only be paid for using his dinner money from school. So for one day a week, he'd go hungry to pay for his magazine.
But it was worth it.
Yeah, he became a bit of a geek, and then he became an aviation geek, and it's not been lost from there. And, of course, Joseph has been very kind enough to design the logos for the extended aircraft that you see every now and then appear on social media. Dave Homewood from the Wings Over New Zealand show sent us this message.
G'day, I'm Dave Homewood from the Wings Over New Zealand show. In a recent extended episode, the guys were talking about their backstories, how they got their passion for aviation, and they were asking how others found theirs as well. Well, I was quite interested to find that their backstories are very similar to mine. My passion for aviation came from my dad, Gordon Homewood. He actually grew up right across the road from RNZAF station Ardmore, which is now Ardmore Airport, the home of New Zealand Warbirds, and also the home of the likes of Avspecs and Pioneer and some other really amazing companies that are turning out Warbird restorations these days. Some of you may be familiar with the Mosquitoes and the Spitfires and the Kitty Hawks and all the other aircraft that have rolled out of that place. Well, Dad grew up right across the road. Between 1943 and 1945, during the war there, it was a fighter base. He used to tell stories of the Kitty Hawks and the Corsairs and the Circuit and the Harvards and the Hudsons and Avengers that used to visit in there, and various things used to go on, and how he and his brother used to sneak onto the station using the drains. There's a drainage system all around that's still there on the airport, and they used to cross the road, slip into the drain, and then use that as a little trench to go all the way across and watch the aeroplanes up close. One time they nearly lost their heads because a fire engine that had a Bren gun on the back that used to drive around the perimeter and fire into the drains to scare the birds out that were nested in the drains fired right above their heads, and it was dusk and they nearly lost their heads. So various little stories like that used to get told. Stories of Corsairs crashing into their paddock because their farm was right across the road from the end of the runway. Occasionally there would be overshoots and engine failures, and one particular Corsair that he remembered vividly that came down as it came to a halt in the paddock where he and his father were actually standing working. The pilot had tried to get out, and the canopy had slammed shut and cut the pilot's hands off. He didn't die. Dad actually thought he died. I've looked into it and he didn't die, but Dad remembered vividly picking up one of his hands and holding it as a kid, and the fingers all wriggling, and that was one of his most vivid memories of those times. But yeah, so we grew up with these amazing stories from Dad and from Nana, and Dad definitely caught the aviation bug at that young age, and got into modelling, and he used to build radio control aircraft and helicopters and gliders and anything you could think of. He was also into boats and cars as well with the radio control stuff. But he took it to the extreme because back in the 1970s he was president of the Cambridge Model Aero Club and also the national body, which was New Zealand Model Aircraft Association, for a couple of years. And then in the 1980s, he founded the Cambridge Amalgamated Radio Modellers, which also included boats and cars and anything else, and with the aeroplanes, and he was very passionate about it, and he actually had a model company that he started called GRH Hobbies that sold model parts. And so this kind of thing was happening all around me as I was growing up, and I think through osmosis that became my life. I just learned about aeroplanes, I learned about aviation, and I started reading up about it, and I got particularly interested in the history of the Royal New Zealand Air Force, and that led me into eventually joining the Royal New Zealand Air Force at the age of 18. I served in the safety and surface trade, and it was while in the Air Force that my real interest developed, because I got posted to Wigram, which was the RNZAF base in Christchurch, but it's also the home of the Air Force Museum of New Zealand. And I used to pop in there regularly and got to know some of the guides who were all World War II veterans back then in the 1990s. And, you know, I loved going in there and listening to their stories and asking them questions and stuff like that. And I was always, I got into static modelling, scale modelling when I was young. I never did the RC stuff like Dad, but I still remember Dad bringing home a 144th scale Bandai Mitsubishi Zero model for me, and he and I made it together, and I've still got that model somewhere. It was really cool, and that was my first model. And I went on to building a whole lot of really bad Revell and Airfix and all that kind of kits, and then later on in life I got the better quality Tamiya and Hasegawa kits, and I was a modeler for a long time. I haven't done it for years though, I just haven't got the time anymore, but or the patience. But I think that's what really led me into my interest in aviation, and that led to my project, which started in 2003 and went online in 2004, which is Wings Over Cambridge, looking at the history of the people of my town of Cambridge who served in the Royal New Zealand Air Force and other air forces during World War II, and that's now expanded massively to World War I and to post-war, and all sorts of other things are on there as well. But that was a catalyst for my passion for the stories of the people who were involved. It's not just about aeroplanes, it's not just about the mechanics and the design, it's the people that really interest me, and you know, being able to actually track some of these people down. I've tracked down a lot of them and sat down with them and, you know, heard their story firsthand, recorded it, and shared it on that site, and then that's just expanded beyond that. It's gone beyond Cambridge now, but that's my true passion is meeting veterans who were there and getting their firsthand accounts, and often the story's never been told, and the stories that often add more to what's already out there. There's so much that I've learned through meeting veterans, and I think now I've probably interviewed around 400 veterans over the last few years, and I just wish I had time to get a lot more, because unfortunately they're disappearing fast. Even our post-war guys, the 1950s and 60s guys, are disappearing fast. So and of course that website, Wings Over Cambridge, that led to a direct spin-off, which was the Wings Over New Zealand Aviation Forum, which is where I became well-known, famous almost, because of the forum, and it's just an amazing place for discussing aviation, and New Zealand aviation in particular. And as a spin-off of that, which started in 2005, then in 2011 I started the Wings Over New Zealand Show, which is the aviation podcast, and it was New Zealand's first aviation podcast. I've only just recently discovered that there's now a second New Zealand aviation podcast, which is good. They're more about airliners. I'm more about people stories. But and that's really what my journey has been, and it all goes back to Dad. And I always think, I just wish that, you know, he was still around to see what had become of Wings Over Cambridge and the Wings Over New Zealand Aviation Forum. I'd only just started the forum about 2 or 3 months before he died. And so he never really got to see its potential and what it's become. And the thing is, the things that it's led to, and the people I've met, and the amazing stories that have been recorded, and the history that's been brought out through the forum. And the same with the show. The show has now recorded, I've got 116 episodes up online now, and they're all amazing stories. They're not about me, they're about other people. You hardly ever hear me in them, which is good. I just love listening to people. I love hearing the stories, and I just love the first-hand history. And, you know, you can go to Wings Over New Zealand and look up and find veterans, or you can find current pilots, you can find aircraft owners, you can have museum people and all sorts of stuff in there, and it's all different aspects of New Zealand aviation. And really, I wish that my dad was around to have been a part of that, because he is the beginning of it all. And that's my story, yeah.
So for Dave, modelling and his father influencing him, I think he mentioned there that he was on episode 115. I think he's up to about 120 now. His last one was excellent and well worth it if you're into Second World War and post-war aviation history. And finally, good friend of the show, Micah, sent us his story.
August 26th of this year marks the 47th anniversary of my very first flight. Perhaps more importantly, August 29th, 2016, marks the 100th anniversary of a historic, yet mostly unknown event that may be the greatest peacetime naval disaster to ever befall the United States Navy, and is also the reason I got to fly for the very first time. You see, on August 29th, 1916, the armored cruiser USS Memphis, while on station in the Caribbean, was picked up by a tsunami and thrown up onto the rocks of Santo Domingo. Although few people know of this historic event, my connection with it is strong and very personal. Based on that, and Aviation Extended's request for a first aviation memory, I thought I would retell the story of my first flight. It originally appeared on the Airplane Geeks podcast, episode 238, in March of 2013, but this version includes some new material. I hope you enjoy it. So here it is, my first flight. To truly tell the story of my first flight, I need to tell you a little bit about my family. Now, many Airplane Geek listeners know of my mother, Harriet, who left us in June of 2012 as an octogenarian airplane geek. But this story involves my paternal grandfather. My grandpa Max lied about his age to join the Navy. The Navy believed he was born in 1896. Being that his government birth record was destroyed in a fire many years before his death, and he lied about his birth year for so long, even he was never sure of the truth. No one ever knew if he was really born in 1897 or 1898. We don't know what year he joined the Navy, but we do know he was so small and skinny at the time that the recruiting NCO weighed him in, turned him down, and then sent him away with a nickel, telling him to go down the street and buy a quart of milk and a whole hand of bananas. Grandpa Max was told to eat and drink it all and come back to be weighed in again. He dutifully followed his first orders. Part of his Navy training included sailing the square-rigged USS Constellation built in 1854 to her final resting point in Baltimore. He was part of a Mexican campaign in 1914, serving on board the USS Celtic off the coast of Veracruz. In 1916, as a water tender on board the armored cruiser USS Tennessee, later rechristened Memphis, he sailed down the east coast of South America, through the Straits of Magellan, up the west coast, and through the then-new Panama Canal. During World War I, he was assigned to four Piper destroyers in the North Atlantic. While not a submariner, at one point he was on board a submarine during a test dive, probably an O, R, or S-class boat he couldn't remember. He said he wasn't bothered by the close quarters, as he always served in an engine room. But it was one of the only times he was really worried while on board a naval vessel, as he just wanted to know they would surface. After leaving the Navy, Grandpa Max joined the Merchant Marine and retired from the sea when he married Grandma Sadie. He worked for the U.S. Customs Service until he retired in the mid-50s. So as I hope you can see, my Grandpa Max was one tough old salt. In 1966, he developed an inguinal hernia and needed surgery. This was a much more difficult procedure back then. And while he was recovering in the hospital, my father found the newly published book, The Wreck of the Memphis, and gave it to him as a get-well gift. The armored cruiser Memphis, formerly the USS Tennessee, was picked up by a tsunami on August 29, 1916, and cast ashore onto the rocks of Santo Domingo. For many years, maybe up until this day, it was the greatest peacetime naval disaster in U.S. history. Although Grandpa Max was not on board at the time, he did serve on her during a previous cruise just before her rechristening. Now, while an educated man, Grandpa Max was not an avid reader, but he tore through that book and found that there was an organization of former shipmates called the Survivors of the USS Memphis. He contacted them and attended their next reunion, which was in Chicago in August of 1967. Grandpa Max had always enjoyed traveling by bus. The Greyhound lines were almost luxurious back then. He had taken the Greyhounds from New York to California to visit his brother, to Chicago for the Survivors of the USS Memphis reunion in August of 1967, and with me to the next reunion in August of 1968 in Memphis, Tennessee. The reunion in Memphis was a wonderful experience, but the bus trip itself was beleaguering. In 1968, civil rights had not spread much below the Mason-Dixon line, and Grandpa Max could not abide by the segregation instituted by the bus lines. After that trip, he vowed to never patronize them again. And based on that, he decided that for the next year's reunion, in New Orleans, we would fly. Fly? We would fly? I would fly? I was a 13-year-old boy who grew up loving airplanes. I had never flown before. I wanted to fly more than anything in the world. I was never more excited in my life, and that excitement lasted for a whole year. Grandpa Max had talked to friends and heard that the best seat on an airplane, in coach class, was the first seat behind the bulkhead to first class. I knew this had to be right, as Grandpa Max knew everything. I had prepped for my flight, too. My father, who had served in the U.S. Army in World War II and was what he called a retread when he was recalled to duty as an officer in the U.S. Air Force Medical Service during Korea, had told me that I may need to clear my ears, and he taught me how to do so. It was about 8 in the morning on August 26, 1969, when we left for the then recently renamed John F. Kennedy Airport for our 10:30 flight. I don't even remember checking in, but I do recall climbing on board a Delta Airlines 707. We took our seats on the port side, and we had the whole row to ourselves. We were ready for takeoff. The stewardess, yes, stewardess, remember this was 1969, the stewardess gave us a safety demonstration, and Grandpa Max watched closely. He noticed that there was no place above our heads for oxygen masks, and he asked the stewardess where they were. She pointed to a small panel in the bulkhead, and Grandpa Max seemed satisfied. We taxied, made our takeoff roll, and we were soon airborne. I was looking out the window the whole time. I was flying. I must have had an ear-to-ear grin. When we leveled off, I cleared my ears, just as my father taught me. Grandpa Max, who had been rather quiet since the takeoff roll, looked at me, and with an urgent tone in his voice, almost shouting, said, "Do you need the oxygen?" At the same time, he wedged his fingernails under the oxygen mask panel in the bulkhead and pried it open. He was reaching for a mask when I told him that I was just clearing my ears. Grandpa Max slammed the panel closed and looked at me with clear relief on his face. A few minutes later, the stewardess came by and asked if we wanted anything. I remember being quite startled when Grandpa ordered a double Jack Daniels. I knew he occasionally enjoyed a drink, but never at 11 in the morning. This was another first. The only other specifics of the flight I remember was changing planes in Atlanta. We got on a Pan Am 707 that, although it was in Pan Am colors, was being operated by a Delta crew. I remember asking about it and the crew saying something about a lease. Now, some 47 years later, when Aviation Extended requested first aviation memories, I reflect back on that day and had two revelations. In hindsight, I should have recognized these two things at the time, and you may already know to what I'm referring from my story so far. The first? Well, I got to share the experience of Grandpa Max's first flight. He was a man who had served in the U.S. Navy when they still had sailing vessels. A man who had witnessed powered flight become a reality, and I had the chance to fly with him at 30,000 feet. I was so wrapped up in my own first time flying that I didn't realize what I was sharing at the time. The second thing, and something that I never saw in Grandpa Max before or any time after, even when he was dying of cancer, Grandpa Max was scared. Of course, it makes sense now, but think about it. My Grandpa Max, 71 years old, maybe 73, he was able to overcome his fears and fly for the first time in his life to take his grandson to New Orleans and meet with old shipmates. For the first time ever, at 11 a.m. on Thursday, August 26, 1969, with the help of two little bottles of Jack Daniels on his tray table and the power of a Boeing 707, Grandpa Max and I were flying. For Aviation Extended, here in Portland, Maine in the USA, this is your main man, Micah.
And like many others, Micah's reflections were from his father and, of course, his grandfather, who took him on a Delta Boeing 707, which then, just before we leave that, begs the question, because that reminded me the first aircraft I ever flew was a Boeing 707. What was yours, Gareth?
Mine was a Cessna.
Okay.
I couldn't tell you what model it was because I can't remember because I'm too old and it was a long time ago. But
And what about you, Tim? What was the first time you went aloft?
I think it would be, it might be a BAC 111 on a Bucket and Spade holiday to Spain.
Right.
BAC 11? Yeah.
Okay.
It's either BAC 11 or a Viscount.
Right. Ooh, that would have been a nice one. I never got on a Viscount, got on a 111. Okay. Well, a massive thank you to everyone who responded, particularly to Tom, Dave and Micah for those great recordings. So, Gareth, the next time we're going to have to think another one up on that. That was really, really successful. Really, really enjoyed that.
I love things like that because it kind of takes you back to where it all began, doesn't it? And it's funny, just sitting here listening to some of those, it's brought some other memories back. For me now as well, you know, things like being on holiday in Norfolk and seeing a Diamond 9 of French Mirage 3s that had been visiting Coltishall. And obviously I'm aging myself terribly with comments like this, but no, it's all good. And so much of it is gone, hasn't it? But hey-ho.
Yeah. Okay, let's go on to talk about books and book reviews. Of course, we always talk about the Aviation Enthusiasts Book Club on Facebook. Of course, Simon's doing a fantastic job there. He's got some great offers and he's currently running a competition for a giveaway on some fantastic books on Russian aircraft. I think you've got until November the 2nd. So if you're not a member of that group, as we always say, it's one of the best groups on Facebook. So get over there, get registered and enter that competition. What's everyone reading at the moment? I'm reading Failure's Not an Option by Gene Kranz. Got to say, I'm struggling a little bit with it, actually. I'm not sure whether I'm going to make it about two thirds of the way through. What are you reading at the moment, Gareth?
I have read that. I enjoyed that. Actually, it's probably not one of the best, but I still quite enjoyed his perspective.
Yeah,
I'm actually not reading an aviation book at the moment, but I did recently reread for the 45th millionth time Robert Priest's fantastic F4 Phantom a pilot story, which is one of the great aviation titles.
What you got on the go, Tim?
War Over the Steppes. So that's E.R. Hooton. It's an Osprey book. Air campaigns on the Eastern Front. So just getting a little bit into it now. And it's just, I mean, the sheer scale of the air war and the losses and the numbers involved is just kind of boggles the mind, you know, when you think about sort of today's sort of military, today's air forces and, you know, you look at what was going on there. So yeah, good read so far.
Any good aviation books you've read recently, Roger?
Well, yeah, actually, it's worth mentioning because I am actually reading a book about the stigma of mental health at the moment, because that's what I'm raving on about, called Paradigms Lost. But aside that, what is a really good book is the story about Douglas Bader. You've probably all read that, and it's just an incredible read. Mm-hmm. And that is, one of the books that gave me kind of inspiration, to crack on with flying training when it was all getting a bit tough.
That's certainly inspirational, wasn't it?
Yeah,
what you had to go through.
Yeah, exactly.
Reach for the Sky, is that then?
Yeah, that's the one. Sorry, that's the one, exactly.
Yeah.
Incredible book.
Fascinating stuff. Okay, as I say, get over to the Aviation Enthusiast Book Club on Facebook and you'll always find something interesting posted there on almost every aspect of aviation aerospace and some space books as well. So thanks to Simon for that. Okay, promoting aerospace. I've got one mention to put out there. Royal Naval Air Station Yeovilton, its International Air Day will take place on Saturday the 8th of July 2017. Tickets go on sale the 1st of November. Now, next year the air station will open its gates to its 40,000 visitors, just as it did 70 years ago in 1947 at the first ever air show. So they'll be celebrating that. Buy your tickets early and there is a discount available to you. So we'll put links to that in the show notes. Gareth, any events you would like to promote?
I just would like everybody, if they haven't done so already, to head to linksaviation.co.uk. That's L-I-N-C-S, as in Lincolnshire. Some big news recently about the quest to make Just Jane the world's third airworthy Avro Lancaster. Some big progress happening this winter and next winter with the aircraft being stripped down, and they're going to address all of the work with the CAA's approval they need to do to make the aircraft airworthy. That'll be a big step forward and exciting times. I mean, we saw, with Vera, the Canadian Lancaster here a couple of years ago, wouldn't it be amazing if we had a second Lancaster in this country, and Mosquito to talk about as well. Brilliant stuff.
And Tim.
Okay, well, we've always got various things going on at the RS, as everybody knows. Check our diary pages, check our calendar. But it's that time of year again. It is the RES annual Aero Pub Quiz is back, 7th of November. Central London, be there or be square. Teams of up to 8. Fun night had for all. Prizes to be won. Beer, merriment, and aviation trivia. Get your team of crack av geeks together.
Right. Okay. We always say we're going to enter, but we never get around to it. So we'll watch this space with interest.
You did say crack, didn't you?
As elite.
Roger, anything else you would like to mention at this point?
Apart from the obvious, the book Speed of Sound, Sound of Mind. I'll just get that final plug in there. not really. To be honest, what I do as a matter of course is follow Health for Heroes on their website, and the same with the Scots Association of Mental Health, and really follow the events because there's always something going on and always something in your local area that you can support.
Okay, excellent. We'll put links to those in the show notes. If you've got an event you want us to promote or some news from your local airfield, email us at getinvolved@aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, this doesn't have to be in the UK either. We're happy to promote events all around the world. Just before we wrap up, our final show this year will have Roland White as our guest host. So if you've got any questions for Roland, he's proved to be a very popular guest, do email them or message them to us and we'll put those to Roland in early December. Okay, that's about it. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to the show. You can find Extended now on Stitcher.com, UKpodcast.com, poddirectory.com, and of course iTunes. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The program's produced with a Creative Commons license. Tim, where can we find you online?
Okay, I'm at RES Timor on Twitter, and the Air Society can be found at www.airsociety.com.
And Gareth, how about you?
Gareth_Stringer on Twitter and globalaviationresource.com.
Roger, reminder for the book, where can we find it?
Yeah, so you can find it at on Amazon and just search for Speed of Sound, Sound of Mind, or on our Facebook site, which is basically the hub. So facebook.com/speedofsound2016, or you can follow me on Twitter, and that is at Rog Cruikshank, R-O-G-C-R-U-I-C-K, Shank. Thanks.
And you can find me at Mascot Hornet on Twitter and at xtpmedia.co.uk. That's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from Tim Robinson.
Goodbye, everybody. See you next time.
Goodbye from Gareth Stringer.
Goodbye, folks. Thanks for listening.
And goodbye from Roger Cruikshank.
Thanks very much, everyone. Thanks for having me.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme. Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need. Extended.
This is XTP Media.